Today's podcast is brought to you by Zipcar.com. Earn $25 of free driving credit at joinzipcar.com/filmwaxradio. Everybody, this is Adam Shartoff, your host of Film Wax Radio. You're listening to episode number 379 of the podcast. DocNYC just ended. It's the largest American documentary film festival. It takes place here in New York every November, and it just came to an end the other day. And the last episode, I had on filmmakers from three different films or three different documentaries that screened at the festival. We focused on All the Rage, directed by Michael Galinsky and Sugi Hawley. We had The Lure, directed by Thomas Leach, and Letters from Baghdad, directed by Ziva Olbaum and Sabina Krambuhl. And I got to see a few more films while I was at the festival, including Off the Rails, which is terrific. Hopefully we'll bring on that director, Adam Irving, to talk about that film and his subject, who New Yorkers may be familiar with, Darius McCollum, who has, over time, over many, many decades now, has... Basically, he's illegally driven buses and subway trains. There's a man who has Asperger's, and this is what makes him feel alive and feel good and feel centered. And it's an amazing story, and I got to see that. And I got to see Feral Love, which is about I guess you could say from the outside she looks like a really typical cat lady, but she's not. It's a really entertaining story, which is directed by Marky Hancock. And lastly, I got to see a documentary called Borderline, which is directed by Rebbe Ratner, who focuses on a woman who has lived with borderline personality disorder for some time. And it's a very, very fascinating story. So, but these and more, you know, and I'm sure we'll eventually get on all the filmmakers and maybe some of the subjects as well. Anyway, this episode is a terrific one, and actually deals with a mixture, a combination of fiction and nonfiction. I'm very excited to announce the interview that I did with Anna Biller, who a couple of years back made a film called Viva and is now back with a new film called The Love Witch, which opens today, Friday, November the 18th, here in Brooklyn at the new Alamo Draft House, as well as at Nighthawk. But Anna is in the city today. She comes from California. She's here to do at least a Q&A or two at the Alamo Draft House. So if there are still tickets, go check it out. I really highly recommend The Love Witch, which is, even though it looks like a movie that was made 30 years ago, it's a contemporary story, but it's about a beautiful young witch who is determined to find a man to love her. And it has a very kind of gothic feel to it, but it's full of just vivid, bright cinematography and a great central performance by this young actress, Samantha Robinson. But on the show today, and in this first segment, is Anna Biller. It turned out to be a great conversation. We did it at the Showbiz Studios in the East Village. Thank you, Anna, for coming in for that. And then after that, we are going to have a conversation with Alex Lehman, who is a young director, also from California. He was in this week because his film, this documentary called Asperger's or Us, is currently playing. Now, it was playing in New York City this last week, and I didn't really have an opportunity to post the show quick enough to really take advantage and promote that particular screening. However, like many films, independent films like this documentary, which is about a comedy troupe of four guys, all who have Asperger's, and they're based in Boston area, and this is about them. But the good thing is the film Asperger's Are Us Again. It is available on iTunes and on Amazon and probably other platforms as well. You should go check it out. And I should mention also, Asperger's Are Us was executive produced by the Duplass brothers, and Alex's narrative film called Blue Jay, which is also recently in theaters, stars Mark Duplass and co-stars Sarah Paulson, And that is available on iTunes as well. So we're going to discuss those two films and more with Alex in the second segment. Lastly, Jeremy Workman back on the podcast, who was on episode number 260 when he brought on his film Magical Universe. He's back with two collaborators on this omnibus, documentary omnibus film called True New York. It has actually five shorts thematically about New York City. And the two of the filmmakers that collaborated on one of the shorts, Sam Coleman and Ben Rosen, are here to discuss their short, and we'll get to that in a little while. So first up here is the amazing Anna Biller, super talented, amazing storyteller. Go see The Love Witch, please. Make note, you'll want to see it. And because of its outstanding cinematography, its outstanding editing, its outstanding set design, its outstanding costume design, you will need to see it on the big screen. Okay, not your phone, not your tablet, not your laptop, not even your flat screen TV, but on the big screen in a movie theater. And in New York, especially if you're listening to this podcast, or LA, which is where I would say probably the majority of my listeners live, not remotely all of them, but a good number of them, this movie is playing in theaters. So please do make a point of going to see The Love Witch. And let me tell you, it's a sexy movie, just in addition to everything else. So a lot of value add there. Okay, so let's get into my conversation with also the very beautiful and lovely and talented Anna Biller.
After Jerry died, the cops wouldn't stop harassing me. They couldn't prove anything. They actually thought that I killed him. Anyways, San Francisco got to be a really bad trip after you left. And that's when I remembered you had that extra apartment.
Hey, I'm Trish.
Hi, Trish.
Well, what do men want?
Just a pretty woman to love and to take care of them.
Love me. Love me.
What I'm really interested in is love. You might say I'm addicted to love. You want to take a girl up there now? You want some?
What is it?
Well, I met this great-looking guy, and I used love magic on him. Then he got really weird on me. All these emotions started flowing out of him. Then he got really sick.
Well, Anna, it's a real pleasure to. So I've been coveting this interview for months now since I saw The Love Witch.
Oh,
yeah, right. Yeah. You know, it's spectacular. It's entertaining and it's beautiful. It pops, baby. Now, I will confess, even though I'm familiar with Viva, I haven't seen it, and so I apologize. And I even at one point said, "Note to self, kind of see your previous films and all that," but I apologize. I did not do it. So I hope to still achieve that soon.
Okay.
So you might have to educate me a little bit as to. But I did read a little bit about them. And they look like they're, unless I'm mistaken, you're creating kind of a little bit of a universe with your aesthetic and
I think every film creates its own universe.
No, I'm saying in a way collectively with a couple of your films so far, like. You're not making, they feel like they occupy the same universe.
Yeah.
Artistically or
yeah, well, I think a lot of that has to do with my interest in color and design and my interest in a classic studio lighting.
Mm-hmm.
It creates a certain type of look that is unique in today's cinema because nobody lights like that anymore, especially the lighting.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost impossible to find a DP that will light like that today.
Yeah, it's anti-Merc. It's bright, right? I mean,
there's a special alchemy that happens when you have a lot of light and then you have a film emulsion, and there's a special magic that happens where you capture color and you capture life kind of more beautiful than it is, And I think that most films capture life to make them look less beautiful than life is. Like, when I walk around, I see colors. And when I watch movies that are made today, I don't see any colors. I'm seeing that gray and blue mm-hmm. and lack of color. It looks like everything is shot in the fog and through a murk and through gray filters. That's not how I see my world. I think people say that my films maybe look artificial to them, or they think that
stylized is the term that you.
Yeah, but I think offered. You know they think that contemporary films look more realistic. But what I'm interested in is psychological realism. I'm interested in the mind's eye of realism. So how I shoot films is how the older films are shot. So for example, if you're watching somebody talking, let's say I'm looking at you and I'm talking to you. Your face is going to appear brighter and clearer to me than the background because my eye is focused on you, and you're going to appear to be much brighter than you actually are in the space. Mm-hmm. Now, if I shot you with a video camera and I didn't like this, then you would look actually less bright than you look to my eye and less in focus. And so that your eye has more stereoscopic vision than a camera does. So a camera mm-hmm. flattens everything out. So what they used to do in cinema is they used to light in order to make it look more like how it actually looks to your reality. And this is, so it's actually it's sort of like illusionism in painting. Mm-hmm. You're actually capturing more what your eye sees when you do light it artificially than when you don't light it.
But even then, right, back in the days of certain genre of film, that we would say it looks theatrical or stylized, again, that word, and you know, we do recognize that. We don't say, oh, that's the way I see things. Now,
yeah, but when if you were living back at that time and mm-hmm. that was the cinema you were watching, you would think you were looking at realism.
Okay.
So the thing is that what our concept of realism is created by the art that we look at.
Okay.
So any style that's popular in art at any time is considered what realism is. And realism has changed. Yeah, realism has changed throughout the centuries in painting. What was considered realistic mm-hmm. 500 years ago is not what was considered realistic 100 years ago or today. Mm-hmm. So the idea is like what life is, what life looks like, has changed. So the idea is like in the old Technicolor films, because they were in color, they were considered very lifelike. Now, mm-hmm. before they had color film, the black and white films were considered incredibly lifelike. Mm-hmm. And so the idea is that I'm just saying that to my eye, video captures life less realistically than film. And I think when you don't light things, it captures settings less realistically than when you do light things. Because, again, because our perceptual reality is much richer and fuller than a camera lens. And so what they used to do is they used to put that three-dimensional. So it's like a screen is two-dimensional and your eyes are three-dimensional. So what you're doing is mm-hmm. when they used to light films, they used to put that three-dimensionality back. Now, because we haven't seen that in cinema in so long, people kind of gasp when they see there's like color and depth. Mm-hmm. But color and depth, that used to be the whole technique of photography and cinematography, was to capture that kind of depth. Mm-hmm. And so I experience great emotion when I watch a film and I look at a close-up. And there's a head, and that head looks like it's in 3D, and the roundness of a head on the flatness of a screen is something that creates great emotion in me, and I think in a lot of people. So the idea is that just the art of lighting a close up, or the art of lighting a set, mm-hmm. where you have to light it really brightly, and then you have to recreate all the shadows. It used to be called Painting with Light. There was a book. There's a famous book by John Alton that's called Painting with Light, and he was a great mm-hmm. classic cinematographer. Mm-hmm. So when you're talking about me creating a world, what I'm doing is I'm actually using classic cinematography techniques, which were used for decades before they stopped being used quite recently.
Right. But I don't know about Viva. When does that story take place?
It takes place in 1972.
It does. Okay. And I think The Witch.
The Love Witch. The Love Witch takes place today.
It does take place today.
Yes.
So I'm okay, because I was about to kind of challenge you, but I can't. Because I'm going to say, but you're setting the films back. But we do, because of that, I associate the lighting.
You associate those
with
techniques
films from the 70s,
with films from the 60s, you know, the 50s, 60s,
50s,
or 70s.
60s, the Jacques Demy, through, and even like kind of guys like Radley Metzger, who I know, I assume is also something of a...
Yeah, Radley Metzger was a very good director.
I know. I think so, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. And someone who I've had the privilege of having lunch with him a half dozen times.
Oh, that's nice. Well, you know, Viva, actually, I did take in some inspiration from Radley Metzger for that movie. But for The Love Witch, I was taking inspiration from classic Hollywood, much more from like Hitchcock and Zirk and you know, noir films and pre-code films. And I really wasn't looking at any of the kind of sex films for The Love Witch, because it's really not a sex film. It's about love. I was looking at Gertrude, Dreyer's Gertrude, looked at that. I mean, that was the very first film that inspired me for The Love Witch, because it's got similar themes.
I'm sorry. And you shared watching these films, right, with your lead actress, who plays Elaine.
We mainly watched a lot of movies, as many as I could find to show her about, you know, pathologically narcissistic or sociopathic females in classic film cinema.
I'm glad you brought that up, because a lot of us who are, you know, relatively crazy about movies or care a lot. When I was young, I saw a lot of movies with Joan Crawford, but I don't consider her in that same category. Like, I think she's just outright sometimes aggressive in her ambition.
She did a film called Possessed, where she played a manic depressive or maybe schizophrenic character.
Was that later in her career?
I think it was in the 50s, and she did, might have been the late 40s, but I was looking at films with Samantha that were actually sociopathic or narcissistic characters, films like Leave Her to Heaven,
right,
or The Locket, or Angel Face with Gene Simmons. So where the character actually has a problem, has a very, very deep and serious personality disorder.
And part of it is maybe masking it with trying to appear normal, potentially, right?
Well, what's so fascinating about the classic movies, and when they would show like female mental illness, is that it was such a requirement for women to be socially presentable, soft-spoken, you know, pleasant. You know, they had there was a lot of pressure, I think, on everybody in society to really conform and to put on a social mask that was very, very even. So it's kind of interesting in these films when the mask cracks, even when it's a man, but especially when it's a woman, because the women, I think, they there were so many constraints on them socially from living in a man's world. So that in a lot of times the reason they'd crack is because they'd had so many tough breaks in life. Just horrible things happening to them that would cause these kind of mental disorders. So we didn't go so far as to look at the snake pit or anything like that. We were just looking at women who seemed relatively normal, but then they had these personality disorders, which is what I wanted for the character. Because I really wanted her to be like the seductress, but I wanted to show the inside of seductress, to show, because everybody, you know, what's funny is that when, you know, when men look at it like a femme fatale in a movie, again, they think about whether she's good or evil, but they think about whether she's good or evil for them, like if she's going to be bad for them, you know, so a woman might look like at an evil woman in a movie and they'll think, yeah, identify with her struggles, and I could get like that if my buttons were pushed like that, or you know when you're dating. So it's kind of interesting because men have talked about, there's a scene with this character Wayne, and he's kind of almost like weeps himself to death or something, from a broken heart from Elaine's love spells in the movie, and men have talked about how hard and cruel and cold she is to him, and she doesn't respond to his pleas to pay attention to him and love him. And women talk about, like, what a jerk, you know, like, so what about the fact that he's talking in this horribly insensitive way, you know, after they've made love, about how he feels about women, and he's such a jerk. And you look at her face, and her face is hard and cold, but maybe her heart is being broken at that moment, you know, so a woman might look at that and say, God, she's put all this energy into this whole thing, but this guy's not worth it. This guy just isn't. He's just such a jerk. He's just like all her love with all her energy, and this guy is just—he's just bad. He's just a bad guy. So the men are thinking, you know, she's evil. The women are thinking he's a jerk, and that's on purpose. I loved the idea that you can create scenes that will have those different emotional effects for different people. I just think that's so interesting that you could, you know. And it's kind of like how the classic movies worked as well. You know, they were for everyone, and there was something for everyone.
Right. It brought appeal. Broad
appeal. Because you're not just... Unintended. Because I think so many movies now are really just for men, and they're made just for men. And at some point it was discovered.
Which is odd because, I mean, historically, women were probably more, if as large,
well, you know,
if
what,
not larger part,
well, you know,
of
what
the
studios, you know what the studios found out? Is that women will watch anything, especially if their guy drags them to it.
Mm-hmm. But a guy won't.
Men will not watch women's pictures.
Right.
And so if you make a man's picture, then everybody will go to see it. If you make a woman's picture, then less than half of the population will see it. So it's considered bad box office to make women's pictures.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But in the old days, men and women would go watch women's pictures because there was always something in it for the man as well.
Like the woman cracking up, or
they had strong male characters, mm-hmm, that were driving the action, mm-hmm, and a movie like Mildred Pierce, you're talking about Joan Crawford, she's one of my favorite actresses, mm-hmm, a movie like Mildred Pierce, you know, there are a lot of male characters in it as well, but also
most of them were having sexual relations with the daughter.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's the other thing. You've got Anne Blythe, who's just incredibly gorgeous and incredibly sexy. Mm-hmm. You know, but then you've also got, you know, people they weren't looking at movies in those days in such a simple way as they do now. It wasn't just about, this is my ego, this is my libido. Mm-hmm. Mildred Pierce is an incredibly finely drawn character. She's well written. Mm-hmm. And in those days, a man, you know, was interested in following a drama for the sake of the drama, for the sake of the narrative. You didn't care if it was a man or a woman on the screen. It's a good drama. Mm-hmm. You see what I'm saying? It's, mm-hmm, like people like theater. They used to go to theater and they used to look at narrative, and they weren't just looking at, like, you know, are there guns in it for me, or is there war in it for me, or are there action figures? Is there action in it for me? I mean, everybody's sort of gotten really, it's weird. Like, it's almost like movies become like video games, like for men, and they're, It's movies become about people's drives rather than their minds.
Yeah.
So.
Right. I haven't thought about it quite on those terms. How they become more just targeted to, like, everybody has their own movies, like, so.
Yeah. Well, people used to read literature. They used to read novels. They used to go see plays.
Sure.
And so it was so guys, you know, in the '50s, they, mm-hmm, wouldn't go see a play and it had a female lead and go, oh God, I don't want to go see that. You know,
right.
That would never happen.
Yeah.
This is a good play. It's a good play. It'd be good. Good playwright, you know, good, mm-hmm, good actors,
right?
That
and they were written by men
happening.
Anyway, so, you know,
they didn't need their egos to be stroked by having a male, mm-hmm, you know, lead.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't so. Men have changed.
Oh yeah, sure.
Yeah,
are we less feminine, do you think, or maybe?
I think just kind of dumber, maybe. Kind of dumber.
Could be.
We're dumber all around, all of us, including women. Everybody, we're all out dumber.
Because
most of us don't read, right? And we don't see plays, and we don't actually know how to look at a narrative. We don't know how to read a narrative.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we don't have most of us don't have the haven't had the exposure or haven't given ourselves the exposure to read the classics anymore, and or, you know, like, we're just not doing that anymore, and we're going back and looking at, you know, like the Pantheon or whatever you want to call it, you know, film. Like reading the plays, reading the novels, just doesn't seem like that. Or at least nobody's really having that conversation anymore. Now we're just reading tweets.
I mean, I almost think like the film industry has become like the fast food industry. It's just kind of like you almost in a Pavlovian mind control way get people to like certain things just based on their senses. It becomes like sensory.
But you're talking about the mass marketed cinema. You're not talking about, I mean, there are still filmmakers like Todd Haynes.
Oh, of course. What I'm
who
talking
actually
about,
made his own version of the
right,
Mildred
no,
Pierce.
And no, of course, I'm
Todd Solondz.
No, I'm talking about the movies that are mass marketed to men that are kind of like they could raise the children on the video games,
right,
and they make the movies like video games.
And TV too.
And TV too, but sometimes when people are so kind of addled, mm-hmm, on all this like sensory stuff, they don't want to watch anything that they have to concentrate on a story or anything like that. And I think that's partly what happens. You know, mm-hmm, that they're not interested in like what they're watching is more like being on a ride, you know, in a theme park. It's not really like watching a movie. It's not the same experience. So it's not like they're even trained to even like sit down and watch a movie, any movie,
mm-hmm,
you know, that has like, you know, a narrative, you know, development, that kind of thing.
Right. So if you just after 10 minutes and the assault wears off when you go to a movie and you're kind of calmed back down, but there's nothing you walk away with after that. So generally
yeah, it's like
speaking,
gone from your brain. You know, and I can't even go.
There's no takeaway.
And I can't even go see those movies because I have like a neurological
a little PTSD
disorder.
From it. Yeah.
No, I actually have an inner ear disorder. I've got
do?
I have a condition called vertigo, and so. Like I can't sit through previews. I can't sit through things like with lots of shaky camera movement. I can't sit through things where camera's like whizzing through space.
Well,
I get extremely ill, so I can't even go.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So at least you have a this vertigo.
Yeah.
So at least you chose a movie that would inspire you as well because of the light and color. So what I wanted to ask you, Anna Biller, who is you're a little bit then of like how you got to this place in your life of making these films, which are very God bless because you're making such we need your films, you know. And what was that journey? I mean, obviously, we don't have 2 or 3 hours to talk.
No,
sure
no, I can tell you pretty quickly.
You have it down to
I can tell you pretty quickly.
Maybe an elongated escalator ride, maybe like in Trump Tower or no, I'm sorry.
No, I was, you know, I've always loved movies, but I went to art school. My dad's a visual artist. And I went to art school and I was making, you know, mainly painting and drawing, but I was also doing videos in art school.
But before school. But you grew up with artistic parents. Like I did too, two graphic artists.
Yeah. My mom's a fashion designer.
Okay.
My dad's a
But they were watching movies, right? These were
in the 80s. They're both cinephiles. They're both watching movies all the time, like only good movies pretty much. Mm-hmm. And they're taking us out to movies and we're going to see all the classics and we're going to see all
and
the
And this
movies.
Was in California? Where was this?
Yeah, Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And my mom especially was obsessed with like pre-code and old musicals and stuff like that. And she worked at home and she's always watching those movies like day and night. And I just, like sucked all that up. My dad was more into like art cinema, more like foreign cinema and stuff like that. And he took us to go see those movies.
Right.
And then, but
kids,
I was just
making Godard's new movie. Yay! Let's get in the car. I don't know.
Yeah, and some of the darker stuff, you know, too. Like stuff that wasn't appropriate for children.
Oh yeah.
You know, like so movies like Casanova. You know, when we were little school children. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I know exactly. I had the same parents. Parents, maybe a little older, but my parents growing up in New York, we were also my parents were members of the Joe's Pabst Public Theater. In the 70s, I was like this big. You too? Well, by the way, we're joined by a couple of your friends. You have a little posse here, Mitch and Jared. Mitch is gesticulating in agreement very enthusiastically. Yeah, he had a similar experience. Did you grow up in New York? You did. Okay. My parents belonged to the public theater, which, yours too?
He's talking to Mitch
now. Yeah,
I'm sorry.
I'm going to make it's okay. You don't have to drop. Anyway, the point is that my parents would take me to David Mamet, David Rabe, and David, who's the third David? Hare. Thank you. David Hare. I mean, plays, Vietnam. My parents took me, and I was 11, they took me to see Short Eyes. That's the one in the men's prison with the pedophiles.
Yeah.
There would be plays about Vietnam and all these things going on, and you know, naked people on the stage, which, you know, I just wasn't quite. You know, this is what I was brought. So I can relate on some level.
Oh, yeah.
And my parents' solution was sometimes to cover, like, just reach
across. Yeah, Mitch told me that his parents took him to see O Calcutta, and then he went on the stage or something.
Oh, really?
No, was it Hair? It was Hair.
Hair.
Okay.
Yeah. Everybody's...
Yeah.
But naked in that play, too.
Yeah.
But at least it's a musical, you know. Anyway, so I'm sorry. But I was asking you about that.
What happened was I was kind of making videos, art videos in art school. And I wasn't really getting into making videos at all. Like, it wasn't doing it for me. I was doing performance art and painting and drawing and printmaking and all this kind of stuff. But when I got out of school, I found this Super 8 camera at a garage sale for $25, and I bought it. And I started shooting my own Super 8 films. And that's when everything came to life for me, became magical. And then I started... I was living in New York for a while, and I was working for a photo stylist, and we learned how to build sets. So I started building sets and in my little basement apartment on East 3rd Street.
Here. Not too far from the studio.
Yeah, very close to here. And, then I went back to school. I went back to school. And what I found was that, you know, I thought they'd accepted me to graduate school because of my paintings. But actually, everyone hated my paintings. They loved these weird little Super 8 films I've been making after I got out of school. I was just like little experimental films. Mm-hmm. Everybody said you need to just be working on film. So then I went into the film department as well. I was like inter-school, mm-hmm. and I was using, so I got to use all their equipment. I started working on 16 millimeter. And they had these sound stages there that I got to use. And they had these lights and they had these cameras and they had all this equipment. I thought, wow, this is like the MGM musicals. I can do something
here. Yeah,
so sure. I started, you know, using those sets. Nobody else wanted to use those sets. Everybody thought that was just so, they were, no, you know, they just
right.
thought
everyone
that,
wants
that
to
was
shoot
so,
outside in the real locations.
Well, everybody was into the French New Wave, like everybody still is. Mm-hmm. And everybody was, you know, just looked down on those studio films like they still do. And but that was like what I wanted to make. I wanted to make stuff in studios and with lighting. So, you know, I made some things that didn't work sometimes. You know, I'd work with DPs and I'd let them control the lighting and I'd realize. So I would just have everything lit to my eye. And I learned cinematography so that I could speak to my DPs and I could learn, you know, how to work with other people on the set. And so this kind of lighting that I have in my films now, which people think I'm trying to imitate something, I'm doing it to my eye. And I think it's because I've watched so many of these movies that there's a type of lighting that looks right to me and there's a type of lighting that looks wrong to me. Mm-hmm. And most people's dailies, if I got those daily, like I watch movies like that are big movies, like big studio movies, and I look at the footage and I think, if I got these dailies back, I'd throw them in the trash and fire my DP because I have such a specific way that I want things to look.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started really learning about design, like how much design has to do with the success of capturing a great image. And I started to really study design. And this was still when I was making short films. So by the time I made my first feature, Viva, I think I was pretty good at figuring out the elements of design, the elements of lighting, and certain things about acting and actors. And you know, all this stuff that I learned in my short films I put into Viva. And I think mm-hmm. that, you know, it was a pretty epic kind of film. I think The Love Witch, you know, I learned a lot on Viva and then I used in The Love Witch. So I think I just keep learning my craft, learning it better. And I'm just doing what I want to do. So I decided a long time ago that there's no point in doing any kind of artwork, any kind of film or anything, unless I'm doing what I want to do. Because other people may not like it. I may not make money, may not be successful. But as long as I'm doing what I want to do and it's true to something that I like, then it's got some value. It'll have some value to somebody. Even if it's only me.
Well, yeah. You first, anyway. You know. What about your parents? What do they? How do they feel about your films?
Oh, you know, they're very hands off my life.
Well, yeah, but I mean,
they're not that interested. They're not that interested in what I'm doing. And
no?
You know, no. Like when the film comes out, then they'll see it and then they'll enjoy it. But they're not involved in my life at all in mm-hmm. any kind of way. They're very, see, because they're not like typical parents who like live through their children. They're still like happening in their own lives.
Yeah.
Like their own lives are the center of their universe, not their children's lives. They're still really like.
You say like that's good. Well, no.
You know, they're
I'm
a great
kidding.
Inspiration to me because they also do exactly what they've always done exactly what they want to do. They were a great example to me because
right.
they don't sacrifice to anyone, including their children. They just like my dad is still at a studio every day painting. They just have a ball. They just do whatever they. You know,
artists are like that though. I think more than the average.
Oh yeah, they're completely
you know,
artists.
They're
actually kind of in a way they're you know some people would call them selfish parents, but I just think they're
or narcissists.
No, they're just
I'm
like
not saying that.
No, they're just. They're just, they just never stop doing what they love. And they're great examples because of that. They're still inspiring me.
But I have that, I know other people that I've grown up with whose parents are artists and it sounds similar. They're like the parents are very wrapped up in their work and they still want to be relevant, make art that's relevant to themselves. You know, not necessarily commercially, but that too, I assume. But they, you know, they still have lots to say, and they still want to find
well,
out
God,
more
I mean,
about the world and
well,
about
sure,
themselves
I mean,
through
I mean,
their art making. And so it requires.
Well,
their,
I mean, that's their life, right?
Yeah,
they can spend it the way they want to.
Yeah,
they don't have to.
I'm just
spend
worried
it
about how
their
I'm
children,
gonna, my kid. All I think about is like, you know, how I'm gonna take my kid's gonna be okay. So I just have to have more
as
faith.
Long as you love them, they're always okay.
Thank you. It's just what I need to hear.
That's all they want.
Okay, just let me sure. Okay, withdraw. Oh, I don't know. I have to get him a phone. That's all I know. Well, Love Witch is already screening in Los Angeles, correct? Am I right?
It opened there, which
is very unusual.
It opened last weekend in Los Angeles.
And how'd that go?
It was fantastic.
People are eating it up. Which theater is it? I'm sure it's held
It opened
over.
At the New Art.
The New Art? Okay.
Yeah.
And it's still there? Still playing? Week two?
No, it's not week two yet.
Thursday will be the end of week one. Okay.
We're still in week
Jumping
one.
Jumping the gun here. But by now you might have an idea if it's going to be held over.
You know, they usually
if it's not, I won't.
They usually don't hold things over at the New Art because they're very tightly booked. But it's booked in a few other theaters in LA.
Oh, good. Okay.
No, it's been fantastic. I mean, audiences are like beside themselves. They go to the movie and they just like they're like almost screaming. I think there's something about there's something about seeing the movie in a theater with other people.
Oh, absolutely.
Where the audience just gets all caught up in this kind of collective energy.
Yeah.
That they become really excited. And this actually happened with my film Viva too, but more with this one. That people, it seems like they're having these moments of recognition, like every couple of minutes or every couple of seconds or something. And it's like they're having these like epiphanies all the way through.
How about the epiphany of this filmmaker actually really really worked her butt off to make this really entertaining first and foremost and challenging my I'm not sleepwalking through this film. Like, I'm actually I'm being provoked and engaged on a level that, you know, and entertained at the same time.
Well,
which
you know, it's really
I thought it's
neat,
like,
though.
Oh, she's doing this on purpose. I'm actually, she's, you know.
Well, you know what's really neat is that everyone is having a different epiphany. That's what's really cool.
People
are not having the same.
How many Q&As have you done? I mean, not including film festivals.
Mostly they've been film festivals, yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, the thing, but it's like everyone's having their different epiphany. It's like a film is like a mirror, right? So it's like reflecting their own obsessions, their own fetishes,
Well, this will definitely.
Yeah, so like, you know.
This has fetishes in it.
Yeah, there have been many fetishes. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people are obsessed with the lead actress, Samantha Robinson, because she's really like in this incredible projection screen where people could just project everything onto her. A little bit like Catherine Deneuve. She had this kind of impassive quality where she became this fantastic projection screen.
Yeah.
And so she becomes like this kind of receptacle for everybody's anxieties and worries and passions and lusts and everything. And so that's kind of interesting.
I know. And she would start off so strikingly beautiful. I mean, she's I'm never stopping beautiful Catherine Deneuve for God's sake. But I mean, at first she just was this fetish object. Then she played with it. And the next thing you know, she's in sort of has control over the perception of herself, you know, and what people's perception. And then she becomes like the grand dame of French cinema.
Mm-hmm.
I always liked Jean Moreau, but she was more in the sulky
she was very sulky.
Very sulky.
Very pouty.
A lot of pouting.
A lot of
smoking. Yeah. But
she was also, in a way, Jean Moreau was the best projection screen was in Elevator to the Gallows, where she was pouty, but she hardly said anything. She was walking around. And I think when you're shooting actresses in close-ups and they're not talking, it's kind of interesting what you get. You know, from the there's all this like this projection that you get. It's kind of like you can project evil or saintliness, or you can project. You know, they used to like shoot old movie actresses in this way, where they became these like glowing projection screens. And so like Garbo's entire fame rested on her close-ups, right? And then there were other actresses, like Ingrid Bergman was like that. So that people would just project this saintliness onto her. And it was about these like glimmering, kind of like nitrate close-ups, shimmering close-ups. And we tried to do that, even though it was in color, we tried to do that with Samantha Robinson
the lead character.
Yeah, so it's like sometimes she radiates a kind of a goodness and sweetness and spiritual quality. At other times she radiates like pure evil. You read all this anger. Mm-hmm. I think part of the reason we're so obsessed with female faces in the cinema is because of I think we regress to infants, and it's like our mother's face looking at us, and we really care if that, you know, that is that face smiling? Is it beautiful? We want our mother to be beautiful, and we want her to be smiling at us. And Samantha Robinson never smiles in the entire movie except for in one scene. I didn't let her smile because I wanted there to be this tension about what she's thinking. Does she love us? She doesn't love us. She rejects us in this way. It's like the rejecting mother, and that becomes the evil person is the rejecting mother. It's only when she falls in love and she feels like her love is being reciprocated that she actually allows herself to smile. And then the tragedy in that scene is that she actually is not being loved back. But and that creates the monster again in her. You know, right. The monster then reawakens at that point.
Mm-hmm. It really is a comedy, everybody. Maybe I'm describing it incorrectly.
Structurally, mm-hmm. You know, I always think that everything is structural. I look at films structurally. So structurally, it's a tragedy.
Apparently, yeah.
Structurally, it's a tragedy. Okay. It has humorous moments in it, but structurally, it's a tragedy. In comedies,
right. Well, people,
comedies end with
lovers die. So
well, yeah. No, comedies end with a wedding, mm-hmm. and tragedies end with death. And in comedies, people get what they want. In tragedies, they don't get what they want. In tragedies, it's a fatal flaw of a tragic hero or heroine that creates destruction.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very much a tragedy. Yeah. It's a classic. It's like a Northrop Frye classical tragedy, mm-hmm. in every sense of the word. So when people are calling it a comedy, what they're referring to is what I referred to before, which is like these little moments of recognition. And when they get these little moments of recognition, and they become like little moments of delight, and they cause people to have like an outburst of a laugh or a laugh of delight. Now, that's not because the film is a comedy. That's because the film is exciting people's ideas and senses in a certain kind of way that films nowadays usually don't. Now, what's interesting is the only screening I had where that didn't happen was a screening at BAM in Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm. Oh, at the Cinema Fest.
Yes.
Last
BAM Cinema Fest. Mm-hmm. And the reason people weren't laughing during that screening is that everybody in the audience was a cinephile that was very familiar.
They got it. Yeah.
Well, no, they were just familiar with old movies.
Right. No, the classic.
It's not that they got it or didn't get it. It's just that they were familiar with the movies that I was referencing, and those movies are not giallo movies. And they're not horror movies. They're actually Hollywood melodramas. And these people in the cinema weren't giggling because they were looking at old movie classic movie techniques. They're actually following the story. Mm-hmm. Now, when you're following the story and you're not distracted by the lighting, the visuals, and everything, then people get sad. So what happened is that everybody in the audience, it was a collective sadness in the audience, and everybody was saying, your film is so sad, and all the Q&A was about the tragedy in the film. I was getting people writing me on Twitter, your movie is so sad, it made me so sad.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you have the audience laughing through the entire movie, then you don't get that sad feeling at the end because they're so used to laughing that they can't transition.
Mm-hmm.
when they realize that the movie's going to end as a tragedy, they can't transition into that other mode. But it's because they've been watching it through a modern lens,
Right.
So they have all these barriers. The barriers that they have are the barriers of getting used to watching a film that doesn't look like other films today. And it takes them 3/4 of the movie to get used to that. And they've actually missed the story by that point. And so I think what's happening is that people are, because they miss the story, because they're so distracted by the style,
mm-hmm.
they say it has no story, or they say it's style over substance because they missed the story. Mm-hmm. Is that not because the film doesn't have a story that's very, it's actually a very linear, very classical story. They miss it because they weren't able to concentrate on it.
It goes back in a little bit to what I was trying to say earlier, which is, you know, you're kind of asking them to pay attention, and
isn't that what you ask people to do when they're watching like a movie, is pay attention, any movie? I think a movie is much better on a second viewing for most people.
Don't
because
think that all the time. No,
because I think the first time people are so surprised by the style that they can't concentrate. It's the second viewing that becomes much better for people because that the second time they can see the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it was the same. The same way with my movie Viva. It was the same way. It was the first viewing. People never understood the movie on the first viewing.
But
I had
think
to see
about
it twice.
When you know you were talking about older audiences or audiences back, 20, 30, 40 years ago. 50 years ago, they, first of all, had more, I think they had a better muscle for focusing. I think they were used to longer movies. I think they were used to longer shots. I think they were used to seeing movies over and over. I know when I was a kid, we had so many fewer films coming out anyway, but it was, and movies were in theaters also for more than a week, typically. And so you would have you go and see a movie sometimes 3 times.
I don't really think that's a problem.
But I don't know if it, I'm.
I think I have a different problem.
But you're saying multiple views can helps people,
right,
because
think,
they're out of practice, I think.
No, I don't think that's the problem with my I'll tell you what I think the problem is.
I don't doubt it. Please do.
Okay. The problem, I think, is because there's been a whole slew of other films coming out in the last 10 years that are spoofs and parodies and pastiches of older types
that's
of cinema.
That's very true.
And because there's so much of that coming out,
They automatically think that's what I'm doing.
And it takes them, many minutes or three quarters of the movie to realize that that's someone.
All right.
Doing.
So who's the guy that did? I'm sorry. Who? I should have been more prepared because now I'm gonna give me a second to remember. I think he's a British filmmaker, but Peter Strickland. Anyway, he did Barbarian Sound Studio. Is I think one the British actor Toby.
Right. Well, I've actually never seen a Peter Strickland film.
Okay. I'd be interested in what you think about that. And the Duke of Burgundy is another, of course. That's a real. It feels like you're very always aware that it's an homage.
Yeah, I'm not doing an homage.
No. We get that. I think you made that very clear.
Yeah. I'm not usually interested.
It's not pastiche. Pastiche would be more of an homage.
Yeah, I'm usually interested in the film as a film. So if the film works as a film and it's a great film,
we don't have to compare
it. Doesn't matter whether it's an homage or it's not a film. Is it a good film is what I care about.
Yeah, I agree. And, The Love Witch happens to be one, so that's good. That's always a good. And it's okay, so the theater in New York?
It's playing at the Alamo Draft House.
Oh, the Alamo Draft House.
And at the Nighthawk, both in Brooklyn, opening this weekend.
The Alamo Draft House. And what was the other? Nighthawk. So two places where you can drink. I'm not recommending you do that. You don't think you need to, but it just so happens you can drink at both of those theaters.
Yeah, and I'll be at a Q&A at the Draft House this weekend, Friday and Saturday night.
Okay, not at Nighthawk? Again,
they schedule a little too tight, so there wasn't enough time for me to go to run back and forth between the two theaters. So they had to cancel the Nighthawk Q&A.
I see.
So we're gonna do a couple of Q&As at the Draft House. Like we'll do two or three screenings there. Q&As.
Yeah, I was over there last week and I saw a movie, so I had a good time.
Oh, good.
It was nice. I've been to others in like Austin, but it was nice that they just opened this like 2 weeks ago. They opened it. So you're going to be one of the first films to play there, The Love Witch.
I'm really excited about that.
Yeah, no, it's going to be sound great, and it's going to look great on the screen. I'm sure, are paying a lot. They paid a lot of attention, I'm sure, to the projection. And if anybody turns on their phone, they're given the boot.
Did you see my promo, The Love Witch, the warning people not to talk and text during the theater? She would pleased.
Okay. So they're going to get it from both the promo that they hopefully will have seen. I may have seen it when I was going to the other movie. They probably were promoting The Love Witch already. So
She says I love men. I love everything about men. But you know what I don't like? I don't like it when people talk and text during a movie.
Oh yeah,
so she's very very harsh on people.
Well, there will be people there ready to take people out by the scruff of their neck. If you turn on it, it's their policy, they'll throw you out. Or if you talk.
But if the Love Witch doesn't want it, then it's really a problem.
That's right.
Because you could end up dead.
Right, you don't,
want to mess with the Love Witch.
Not in a bad way, anyway. Don't get on her bad side.
I mean, people are really scared of her. She's this beautiful young woman.
Well, that's
and
the
people
scariest.
Are scared of her because she's a scary character.
Right. Well, you know how to deal with the ogre with the one eye and the hair coming out of it. That's easier because, but this is a really, sexy.
This is like the most gorgeous. This is like the most gorgeous woman.
It is.
She's so scary. She's so icy cold. There are certain movies that I love that have these like scary, icy cold, beautiful women. Like one of them is V, directed by Petrushko. Another one is Leave Her to Heaven, just completely terrifying. One is like, Ugetsu, I love these movies with these beautiful, scary women.
Well, again, that goes back kind of also what I was trying to... they're like the Joan Crawford, you just know is kind of... She's icy or she's, angry.
I don't see Joan Crawford that way. I find her very, very, very human and relatable.
Yeah, well, I'm saying what I'm trying to, express, though, is also... It's not like there's a some sort of fake mask there,
She's very real.
That's You know what I mean? So it's different, you know. And I keep
but you know what they were playing when they were playing on with Joan Crawford was the idea that she looks really hard, but she always had a heart of gold. The idea is that she's actually quite.
She wanted to be taken care of, maybe on some level. Or
you know what? One of my favorite movies is that movie Torch Song. Have you seen that?
Which one?
With Torch Song.
I have
starring Joan Crawford and Michael Wilding.
I don't think I have seen that one.
That's a great movie.
Okay.
And in that movie, she seems like this hard, this very extremely hard woman, but she's actually really, she just has this like heart that's just so ready for love. Mm. Yeah, it's a wonderful
movie.
I'm
like that too. I really am just ready for my heart to burst.
But the thing is that she's grown. She when she was younger, she was this stage actress who was very, you know, very beautiful and very sweet. But life has hardened her, you know.
Sure.
And so what's happened is that she's become hard looking. So now she can't get a man because she's so hard looking now. So the only man who can fall in love with her is a blind man. Remembers how she used to look. He's a blind pianist. It's such a great story.
God, man, they could write
that. He remembers
how... That? They would never write that now.
Yeah, he remembers
Adam
how she...
Driver winding it up.
He remembers when she was still sweet and soft, a young woman, when she was up on the stage like that. Now, and now men are terrified of her. So in a way, they're kind of using Joan Crawford's own image, in a way, in that story. It's just, you know, fascinating movie. There's also, she sings a song called Two-Faced Woman, which was originally written for the Bandwagon.
Uh-huh.
And so she lip syncs Indy Adams', you know, voice. And
who's
she's literally
that?
India Adams, you know, did Sid Charisse's voice in the Bandwagon.
Okay.
And so, you know, they use that same song. It was already recorded for the Bandwagon.
Save a few dollars in the process. Why not?
and she's wearing blackface in the movie, in the scene.
It's
called Two-Faced Woman, and she's wearing blackface.
Who directed that one? Do you remember?
Oh, who directed that? Was it Michael Curtiz, I think?
Curtiz.
I don't know. Somebody like that. Anyway, and at the end, she's like pulls off her wig, and she's got this like flaming red hair and this black face, and she's glaring out at the audience. It's just, I mean, you know, a lot of gay men love this movie because of the high camp value of it. Mm-hmm. But for me, it's like it's a moving picture. It's a great,
Do you think
it's a great drama.
The Love Witch might also appeal to the camp crowd?
Oh, it already is.
Yeah. That's
yeah, absolutely. All my films very much appeal to a camp crowd, and that's fine. That's great because I'm very campy. Actually, I try to repress it as much as I possibly can.
Look at all their. They'll tell everybody to go see the movie. That's the beauty part.
You know what I do when I'm editing is I try to take all the camp out of the movie. I could go through each pass. It's less campy than the last until I finally get a draft. I think there's no campiness left, and then all the reviews say how campy it is. So I guess I don't totally get it all out of there. You know, like there was something like. I wanted to have a man in a gorilla suit in this movie. It was a scene, and he was going to slip on a banana, or there was a suitor of Elaine's that was going to slip on a banana that the gorilla left there as a practical joke, and it was going to be in the dressing room of where she was performing her burlesque act. And my boyfriend, who's very sweet, he's a professional writer, he really looks out for me, he says, you got to lose the man in the gorilla suit. Because he knows I don't want to be looked at as a camp director. So he told me you got to get, you know, he said that has to go. And he was right. But, you know, I think, you know, somehow my sensibility is, but it's not like the camp now. It's like Mae West camp. That's what I have is Mae West. Mm-hmm. You know, this is like the real camp, you know, the original camp from the 1930s, I think is where I go.
Well, I hope you don't get arrested like Mae West. They arrested her. The Love Witch is opening on November 18th at the Alamo Draft House and the Nighthawk in Brooklyn. Not in Manhattan?
Well...
Fuck Manhattan.
Well, we had a Manhattan opening, and then the theater, which is renovating, was like, whoops, we won't be done renovating. So we lost our Manhattan opening.
Oh, I see. Okay, we don't need... It's okay. You don't need to worry about that anymore. People come
in. No. Brooklyn
for
is
years,
more...
For years, people came
more
in for Brooklyn and Queens, right? To go to Manhattan now, Manhattan can get off their ass.
Oh yeah, they can get off. Yeah, they certainly can come to Brooklyn.
You know,
Brooklyn.
And Brooklyn is things have changed a lot in the last.
Brooklyn is so much more hip than Manhattan now.
Well, it's true, but people move to Manhattan because it's cheaper. Thank you. I have to wind things down. I apologize for cutting things off so quickly, but I appreciate it. Annabelle, you're very lovely and a great guest. You know, my favorite kind of guest. You ask a question, they give a nice, great answers. So. Thank you for that.
Oh, so glad to be here. Thank you so much.
Thank you. For you, the listeners of FilmWax Radio, Zipcar is offering $25 of free driving credit at zipcar.com. Oh, sure, you could call for one type of cab or another, one sort of taxi company to pick you up, but isn't it better to be the driver of the car that you're and drive yourself to your appointments? To earn $25 of free driving credit, go to joinzipcar.com/filmwaxradio. Again, that's joinzipcar.com/filmwaxradio to earn free driving credit.
Hi, this is Melanie Linsky from Rainbow Time, and you're listening to Film Wax Radio.
Okay, so next up here is, again, filmmaker Alex Lehman. The two films you'll want to see that Alex made, the documentary Asperger's Are Us, and secondly, his narrative fiction film with Mark Duplass and Sarah Paulson called Blue Jay. I just watched that a few nights ago with my lady, and we enjoyed it. And then we'll be back again after that with True New York.
It's always fun, because whenever someone asks, I run away in fear.
We're Asperger's or Us. It's true, we're the first comedy troupe composed of people on the autism spectrum.
So if we're not funny, blame it on Ethan's disability. You should come to what might be our last ever show.
We'll be able to do material that we've worked on but haven't performed yet, and also it'll be really, really silly.
We want to sell out Earth.
This is definitely the most challenging show we've had.
We want aliens to come to the show and be turned away because it's full.
There's parts that are screwed up. There's parts the audience doesn't get.
But we're realistic, so if the aliens get in, that's okay too.
It's going to be a disaster. It's going
Don't
to be...
start thinking this way.
I was born this way.
So are you're from California, or you live in California?
I live in California, yeah. I grew up in Philly mostly.
Oh, most in the suburbs? Or
in the Philly suburbs, yeah.
Which one? Or ones?
Devon, Chester County,
okay.
King of Prussia, Valley Forge, all that.
Love those town names.
Yeah.
I mean, I always wanted to live in King of Prussia. That's a sentence. It's not a town. You know, it's...
I took my first movie back there a few weeks ago, the summer movie.
What was that
Blue
one?
Jay.
Blue Jay, right, yeah,
I
of course.
To the Philadelphia Film Festival, and so my mom got to see it in a theater.
Yeah.
And some old friends from high school showed up, and
right.
It was really cool. It was a really, really nice feeling of nostalgia, seeing people you hadn't seen in a long
right.
time and showing up with something you're proud of.
Yes. Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure, like, people coming out and saying, we had you pegged for a loser for sure. And I am, but, you know, when you make a film, it gives you this false impression that you're...
But this loser made a good movie.
Yeah, Blue Jay.
Good job, loser.
I'm almost certain I saw Blue Jay. I was going to look it up surreptitiously, Alex Lehman. I was going to... You're the second person, Alexander, who spells it with an R-E, and I'm wondering what that's about.
I was actually born in France.
It's a French
well.
Thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, just the Philly accent stuck, so a lot of times...
I don't hear it.
I don't tell people the whole France thing.
Okay, so I remember Blue Jay very well, seeing that. No. Wait a minute. You just made this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it just
Wait
came
a minute.
Out. It just it came out like a month ago.
It just came out, and it was at the festival I was at.
We premiered at Toronto.
Okay.
And it was at the Hamptons.
Okay, it was at the
Philly
Hamptons. And
festival.
Okay, how do I see it?
It's on iTunes. Yeah, you can watch it on iTunes right now,
uh-huh.
Amazon Video, all the VOD,
uh-huh.
and it'll be on Netflix. In like a month.
That soon?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's Blue Jay, which now I understand. Mark Duplass is the star of that film, and it makes sense that he and his brother Jay are executive producers on the documentary.
That's the genesis of this, in a sense, I guess. That's the connection, at least.
I'm going to guess Asperger's Are Us, which is the name of the documentary, you made over the course of at least 2 years, 3 years maybe?
Yeah,
I
mostly filmed it just
in the middle?
One summer.
Okay.
And, but, you know, editing and then going
and then there's
out
an
to
epilogue
shoot.
And,
epilogue, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
And it just takes a little while to show it to people and get it into festivals when, you know, when you're a nobody at that point.
Yeah.
So that's how I, you know, I showed it to Mark, and once he was involved, a lot of doors opened. But Blue Jay, Blue Jay, we filmed right before South by Southwest this year.
Yeah.
We filmed it in March.
Okay.
Or no, we filmed it in February. What? And then...
It's just, and then you, that 1 month, yeah. It's like a 20-something day shoot or something, or a 19-day shoot or...
Seven.
Okay, see,
your face was great. I love it. I love when I tell people that, and that's their face. Seven. Yeah, it was a 7-day shoot.
That's incredible. Yeah. But over a course of 21 days. No, 7 days in a row. yeah. Well, I haven't seen it, so I couldn't say, oh, yeah, this looks very, I don't know, like intentionally the way that some of the French New Wave films looked very roughly. You know, they weren't looked too slickly edited, too slickly produced, and they kind of have an energy of spontaneity about it. So you can do it really fast if you've got great actors, and you do. I don't know. It's all guesswork on my part.
No, you know, you pretty much nailed it.
Oh, Clue Gallagher, that's great.
Gallagher, yeah.
Clue,
he's the only other person in the movie. It's Clue. Mostly Sarah Paulson and Mark Duplass.
Mark Duplass and then Clue.
Just one scene with Clue.
Oh, he was a great 50s, 1950s, 60s actor. You know, just character actor, leading man, I guess too. But he was in a documentary I saw not long ago about a movie theater.
And oh, it was probably about the...
I could look it up. I'm right here.
The Beverly, right?
That one. Yeah, that's what it was.
He goes there all the time.
Okay. Yeah, that's right. He's a regular there. That's right. That's what it was. And
he's a buddy of mine.
Oh, he is?
Yeah.
Can you get him on the show? I'm going to keep asking because I want everyone in Blue Jay. This is nice. We'll get to talk about Blue Jay, too.
Cool.
As a value add. Mark Duplass and the great Sarah Paulson, who, you know, is playing, it seems like her age... You know, she has a certain look.
Yeah.
You know, this actress, and she's often cast kind of as a little bit more mature.
More mature, or as a conjoined twin, or
I didn't see that
one. With a crazy wig. She doesn't get to play the just the regular girl, the fun-loving regular girl
right.
that she is. She's very fun, very funny.
Yeah.
She'll make better fart jokes than either of us.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Okay. Carol was an example of what I'm talking about.
Yeah, you know,
like
for
where
sure.
She's playing somebody more mature and more serious, and you know, not contemporary. You know.
Well, she has that side to her for sure. But what we wanted to do with Blue Jays, we wanted to make sure we got to show the other side of her.
Jim.
Hi, Amanda. Tell me about your husband.
Really?
Yeah.
You're not married, huh?
No. Married to the work.
Married to the drywall
work. Married to the work. I'm trying to get through this coffee. This coffee is terrible.
The famous lovebirds, and you're still together.
What's next for you?
I haven't got it all figured out.
I kind of want to see your house.
Sorry. It's all here.
This is amazing. It's like a time capsule.
Amanda.
What?
Would you like to have some fun tonight? Honey, I'm home.
Hi, sweetheart.
Look at this meal. You made all this?
Well.
Hmm? Nope.
She jealous.
Never really been like it was with us.
That's fun great.
Side.
Oh, good. And the romantic side, perhaps. Well, long story. So, Clue Gallagher is in it, and right now it's on a number of digital platforms. But you can stream it right now on iTunes, and you said on Amazon.
And yeah,
maybe I'll do that.
All the platforms.
I really want to see it. This was something I really did want to see. So you're saying you made them concurrently in the general sense, like these two films?
I mean, Asperger's Russ basically wrapped up and was shipped off to South by Southwest.
Oh, that's right. That's where it premiered.
Just before we started shooting Blue Jay.
And then you just, right. Okay.
And then
7 days later,
Blue Jay.
Bada bing.
Yeah. And then Blue Jay beat Asperger's Russ to the finish line. We ended up releasing that just like... You know, a month.
You know, it's like you take, or at the ATM, you feed a crisp bill into this.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like you take your film and you feed it into the Duplass ATM, and then it comes out a film with a whole trajectory. You know, in other words, you can guarantee it'll be on Netflix.
Yes.
good for you, because you know, a lot of people will find it, obviously.
That's the key, especially with, you know, with Asperger's or us.
It's, yeah.
You know, I'm part of it is my pride as a filmmaker. I want to share my work, but there's also something really important about this movie that it needs to be seen. And so mm-hmm. when we were, you know, negotiating with distributors, we knew that we wanted to get it on a platform where people watch documentaries and where it was going to be really accessible. And that was way more important than, you know, making all the money we can make or putting it in theaters and having, you know, a little more clout. It was definitely about how do we get it to people who might not otherwise see it. Mm-hmm. Because I'd originally, when I you know, I self-funded this documentary when I was making it on my own. It was Alex, the cinematographer, trying to make his own movie for the first time. And so, you know, a lot of times when you're making your first movie, nobody's ready to back you.
Right.
So I backed myself with a credit card, and I said, I'm going to make a documentary because the scripts I'm writing aren't as interesting as this comedy troupe that I've come across.
And you literally came across them on Facebook, right? Didn't you? Is that what it was? Or you reached out to them?
It was an USA Today article.
Okay, and then you found them on Facebook.
Yeah,
and
you reached out to them on Facebook.
And a month later, or 2 months, however long.
Yeah, they were a little mysterious for a while, and then all of a sudden they reached out and said, you should definitely come out like in a week because we're about to start rehearsing what might be our final show. So it went from, you know, no communication whatsoever to get on a plane. And funny story, when I showed up outside the mall where we were supposed to meet in Boston, they weren't there. And they weren't answering their phones.
You were ready to call it a day, right? Weren't you? You felt you were being pranked.
Yeah, I thought I was being pranked. I was ready to book a return flight. But finally, I came across.
So you flew from LAX to Logan Airport.
Yep. Took a train.
Took a train to the suburb. Were they in the suburbs?
No, they were in the city. So they're
into Boston.
They're in the suburbs, but they're meeting me in Boston.
Okay.
I had a big black duffel bag full of gear, but it was like just a couple weeks after the Boston Marathon bombing. So all of a sudden. Yeah. So as soon as I was in the train with this bag and people were giving me looks, because it was just like bursting. Yeah,
and you look, I can say, you know, obviously I can see Alex. He's sitting across from me. You look like a menacing person. Okay. You're fair complected. You have stubble and glasses. I mean, you know, in this day and age, that's enough to...
Yes, for sure.
I'm
public enemy number one. No, but something about me, I'm...
Yes.
I'm hyper aware, and I've got a guilt complex that doesn't come from, you know, Catholic parents or anything.
I get you. But, I'm the same way. Yeah. I'm thinking what they're thinking about me all the time. So you go up to people and do the right thing, which is, of course, makes them even more nervous. There's no explosive devices in the satchel. Exactly. Thank you for putting me at ease.
Exactly. I start so many conversations with, not to be weird, but, which...
That's always a bad way to start, but you have no other recourse. I was just going to look at your other... but I do want to focus, of course, on Asperger's or Us, which is now, I can tell people in theaters... It opened Friday.
It opened Friday. Yeah.
It did open. So it is open.
It's in theaters in New York, and then next week it'll be in theaters in LA. It's at the Village East Cinemas.
Okay, at the Village East on 2nd Avenue?
Yep.
That one? Yeah. And then it will be in LA opening up Friday the 18th at which theater in LA? Do you know?
It's the Arena.
Also, speaking of Duplasses, and again, they're the executive producers on Asperger's or Us. I just had on my friend Linus. You know Linus. Okay.
Yeah.
How can you not know? So he's an old friend too, and he his film just opened last week, which
Rainbow
is
Time.
with the Duplass imprimatur. Is that what you call it on it as well?
I feel like instead of because there's all these Duplass movies that are coming out, and like you know we'll go do articles and podcasts and like you know TV
Others?
Shows and whatever.
Yeah.
But there are so many of these Duplass movies coming out. I feel like we should just kind of like Big Brother, you know, the show Big Brother, just have like 24/7 like live webcams everywhere.
Like a constant feed of Duplass characters.
Yeah, of all these movies and shows and things that are coming out of the Duplass offices. It would just be more efficient. Oh,
interesting. That's right. Just have it right. Everybody gets a cam on them all the time.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I like that idea.
No, they're... It's fascinating, and of course, I'm talking about the boss. So, you know, what am I going to do but say something good? But it's fascinating how much they're pumping out great stuff.
Well, it's nice because it most of it is really good. First of all, most of it is about relationships, and they're of course particularly interested in family relationships, and even more specifically between brothers. Not so surprising. If you see a lot of their films, there's usually a brothers or best friends type of things where they're like brothers. It counters the massive amount of other types of movies that are forced upon us relentlessly that are really carbon copies. I mean, I'd have a young son, as I mentioned, I take him to this, Pixar movie, and I'll take him to a superhero movie. And, it's I can't remember which one I saw, with a few exceptions, because they all, it's a formula. And so the Duplasses are at least pushing back with something, offering something. And it seems to be getting into the mainstream zeitgeist. I don't know.
I feel like they're the guys who...
They managed to do it, yeah.
Who started talking about their feelings, and thankfully it was right around the time when it was okay and cool for guys to talk about their feelings.
Yeah.
And they realized that there was a nice market for the therapy movies or whatever you want to call it. just guys being in touch with their feelings and wanting to explore them and share them. And that's cool. A lot of us want that.
Speaking of guys that are trying to share their feelings on film, the four young men that you were referring to before who were supposed to meet you at the mall and who ultimately did, we should say, right? Or also, obviously, that's a major part of Asperger's, right, is being able to connect with others, right?
Yeah, emotionally. There can be some challenges in doing that. There's a false stereotype of people on the spectrum lacking empathy or sympathy and, not giving a damn about how other people feel. It's quite the opposite, but a lot of times there's difficulty in how they express it or how they, they don't read social cues sometimes or facial cues, nonverbal, communication a lot of times, goes over their head.
Yeah. It's interesting because, the Asperger's has hit also a level in the mainstream where we now talk about it a lot and it becomes a punchline. Not that make fun of people that have it so much, but just like... When you're talking to somebody and they're kind of just not getting you and they're disconnected, you'll know, what do you got, Asperger's? It's like...
I know exactly what you're saying.
It's not a venomous thing. In a way, people that if I had it, I would be kind of glad that at least... I don't want people to be so serious around the topic to the degree where they can't, make light fun. I mean, obviously, it shouldn't be meant with venom, but...
Right. Yeah. It's a shame if people are just using that with a negative connotation, if they're only throwing the stereotype of if I sometimes say, hey, what do you have, Asperger's, because you just were able to focus really well on a task and achieve it in a way that most people wouldn't, then that's a great way to throw that stereotype around.
That's true.
But if it's always with the connotation of you're not aware of what's going
you're
on,
you're unable right now. to make a relationship, or you can't make eye contact, you're not a personal person, those types of stereotypes.
Yeah, and some of those apply often, but to be able to just throw around the word Asperger's with the negative connotations only means that you're now not giving people a chance to see what's great about Asperger's. And I think that's my only concern with that. But I think it's really interesting that you brought that up, because the reason I even looked up and found their article was I was working as a cameraman on a bunch of pilots. It was pilot season in LA, and I was working on a lot of comedy shows, and a couple different pilots had an Asperger's joke in it, and making fun of somebody who making the Rain Man joke or the autistic joke or the Asperger's, and I thought to myself, I guess this is the year where it's mainstream acceptable to make the Asperger's joke. And then I just started researching Asperger's in comedy, because I was writing my own script and I was going to write a character who was a foil, who was definitely the guy was a jerk. You need jerks in comedies for sure. And he was going to be calling people, what do you have, Asperger's? What do you have, Asperger's? And he was telling everybody, it's okay. It's okay. It's cool now. It's acceptable to make fun of Asperger's.
It's a disclaimer. That's built into the joke. Yeah.
And so that was the script I was writing. Mm-hmm. And I just felt like I needed to research it more. And then when I came across an article about a comedy troupe with Asperger's, I thought to myself, A, I don't know anything about Asperger's, because I wouldn't have thought that this was possible. B, this is a way more interesting story than anything I could be writing. I put the script down, I picked up the camera, and I said, like, this is the story I want to tell. And I want to learn about these guys, not about Asperger's and autism in general. I knew I didn't want to make just an information doc. I wanted to learn about these guys specifically because the very last line in the documentary is, if you've met one person with Asperger's, you've met one person with Asperger's.
That's fun. That's funny.
Yeah. And I think it's really important to get to know the individuals before you label them. Mm-hmm. So I decided I'm going to get to know these four guys. I'm going to share my experience of getting to know these guys and make that the documentary, make that the narrative in the film.
So you have Noah.
Yep.
New Michael.
Yeah.
New Michael, excuse me.
Yeah.
Right. And what are the two?
Jack and Ethan.
Ethan. That's right. Okay.
Yeah.
And they're a comedy troupe.
Yes.
Other one called
Asperger's
or sketch comedy.
Not improv. They don't like it when you
So no, these are all written and worked out in advance and then performed.
And the irony is they are audiences. Really, really funny off the cuff. They're mm-hmm. very witty. They think very fast. They're way faster thinkers than I am. Mm-hmm. And so when they do Q&As after a lot of their shows, or when they've been doing Q&As, you know, in press, they kill it. They make people a lot of times their Q&As are funnier than their actual shows because they're so fast and so off the cuff. Like, they just catch you off guard and hit you with the best jokes, because you'll ask them a straight question and they'll give you an answer that's a joke, and it's like a 90-degree turn, and it's going to be a pun, or it's going to be a literal response to your question, mm-hmm. which shows you how they could perceive what you said. Mm-hmm. It's very interesting. They should do improv. I understand there's a fear of the unknown and fear of change with Asperger's. That's, you know, that's part of the condition. So, you know, I think they're maybe a little bit nervous about, you know, just getting on a stage and not knowing what's going to happen. But whenever they do it, they're really good. They're really good at it.
Did they were they in town this weekend?
They're in town this weekend. Yeah. Actually, Ethan still is. He and I are doing a Q&A at the Village East in like an hour.
Oh, I wish I knew. We're going to invite them on.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, they're way more entertaining than I am, for sure.
Well, that's their job. So this was, you said before that this was their last show. The documentary follows them as they're doing their final, leading up to
their farewell show.
Yeah. It's like, what is this, like Crosby, Stills, and Nash? It's like, I won't say what happens at the end because maybe it's a minor, I don't think it's a much of a spoiler to say what happens at the end in the epilogue, but you know. That they get back together for a reunion tour a reunion
That's
show.
Fantastic. It took them 18 months, but they got back together. And so, actually, that show that they rehearsed, they didn't end up
even
doing.
Even comedians with Asperger's will sell out, you know, if the price is right, to come back together. Put past grievances aside.
It just takes them a while sometimes to process it all. But that's, you know, like any good group of friends you have, like sometimes there's a lot of layers of emotions you need to work through. And you step away for a second and come back. And they were adolescents. Three of them were adolescents when we were filming this, which, you know, anybody that's, you know, 20 years old is going to, you know, behave that way to a certain extent.
Well, you know, I meant to ask you or mention when you were discussing that this is their farewell show. I mean, the crux of the documentary is about leading up to the final farewell show. But it was in part because they are all at that cusp of adulthood. And going off to school, and this is not just because of, you know, it's just a practical decision that some of them are moving out of the Boston area, if I'm not mistaken.
They didn't end up, New Michael ended up moving to, Lowell, Massachusetts.
Lowell, all the way over to Lowell, which is, UMass Lowell, which is Lowell's a famous town known for being an industrial, like famous industrial town for
manufacturing.
And anyway, it's one of those famous towns for manufacturing. Anyway, so you know, it was like just the timing. They were, I guess, were they around 17 when this?
They were three of the guys were 20, and then Noah.
They were already 20.
The fourth member of the troop, he was 30 because he was their counselor when.
Oh,
when
okay.
They were kids.
They
all met at this camp for autistics, as a performing arts camp, and he was their counselor because he'd joined up, also wanting to meet other people like himself. As you see in the documentary, he only was diagnosed with Asperger's at the age of like 19 or 20. And all of a sudden he realized, I need to meet people like me because this is going to help me understand myself. And so he ended up being their counselor. And then when the younger guys, when they turned 18, they formed their comedy troupe. So I guess they'd been going for about 2.5-3 years when I was making the doc.
Do you have to, when you decided on your subject and it seemed like these guys were good to go, at that point, did you start researching? Because I'm sure you wanted to do your homework. And
yeah, I did some research for sure. And I would ask some more in-depth, you know, scientific questions about Asperger's. Right. Both my parents are scientists.
Oh, they are.
My dad's a neuroscientist. My mom's a researcher. So there's that side of me that was, you know, asking the very intellectual questions. And there was a version of the movie I made, which was digging way farther into the condition and, you know, sociopolitically, how it's, you know, being treated. And I really quickly realized that what drew me to this film was their camaraderie and their friendship. And so I ended up getting rid of a lot of that stuff. And I thought to myself, and I even took out the definition of Asperger's, because I used to start the film.
It's not an advocacy film. It's just
not at all. Yeah.
You know, make no mistake.
Yeah. It's a coming of age story more than anything.
It's about these four kids who happen to have Asperger's.
Exactly.
What did they make of the film? I mean, what did they make of it?
Well, they didn't like it at first, and then they kind of came around to it.
When it got into South by Southwest, they started to like it. And
yeah, I mean, there's a lot that they like about it, and they're very proud of it. They understand what it can do, and how much it can inspire people and entertain them. And you know, I think there's a lot of parents, and there's a lot of other Aspergians that are going to benefit from seeing this. And
what are they called?
Aspergians.
Oh, okay.
I think I've heard that. I've heard that a lot lately, but you know, but I also say Linus Philip, and I know it's Linus. So I mispronounced plenty of things.
It's all right. Everybody pronounces Linus's name wrong at first. But he may not correct you. So
I think I've been corrected.
And it's still ignored.
But then I still
he spells it with an A.
Yeah.
I don't know why that makes a difference. Because mostly, like the Charlie Brown character, we would have a U.
Yeah. Right. And that is the only other Linus I know.
Me too. Yeah. There might be a poet.
Well, I'll have to tell Linus. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I think I'm just stubborn sometimes.
Yeah.
But
trouble.
But I was stubborn with the guys, and I said, because they had to approve the final cut of the film.
Oh, they did?
Yeah. Yeah. There was a deal we had to make.
Oh, really?
Because they wouldn't let me film them otherwise, which is really scary as a documentarian.
Sure. Especially since they're for a committee here.
Yes. And they don't always agree on everything. So I'll never do that again.
Mm-hmm.
But I had to make them feel comfortable, and I didn't have any,
anything else
them.
To offer them.
Yeah.
You know, so it wasn't a big payday.
They get a cut of the film as well. So I think they really out negotiated me in retrospect. Mm-hmm. I think I should have them be my managers or they should represent
me. They're
better
shrewd
negotiators than
shrewd.
I.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting. You brought up Linus again. And I was thinking before, we had a similar conversation. If you go back two episodes or three episodes to when Linus and Melanie Linsky were on,
yeah,
that was nice. That I asked him also about the way he portrayed his character, Shaunzi, which rhymes with Fonzie. Yeah, and I'm like, you know, were you concerned with offending people? Because you know his character is just a little slow, slightly. You know, it's not quite.
It's a fine line.
Yeah,
yeah, for sure. You know, when I
he
heard
didn't
about
get enough oxygen at birth.
Yeah,
I didn't explain. It can be a way of explaining what a lot of stuff.
I think it's very smart.
And
in the trailer, I think it's Melanie's character asks, "Yeah, does he have Down syndrome?" He goes, "No, it's not Down syndrome." Because you immediately need to say, like, we are not going to try to,
we're not taking on that for one thing.
And the movie is about something else, but it is,
yeah.
I mean, it takes some guts to make that, because you could very easily offend, you know, especially this day and age, it's easy to offend. But
right, and also making so many, and Linus actually did point this out, which is to make them like these saintly types, because, you know, that other cliche, which even happens in documentaries at times, where these guys are saints and, you know, the other character that doesn't have it is... learns from, you know, from is, and that does kind of happen in Rainbow Time to a degree, let's face it. But the thing is, it's patronizing. It's a patronizing thing because you know, I think going back to your earlier point, when you said if you've met one person with Asperger's, you've met one person with Asperger's. And that's sure. What greater way of portraying somebody than giving them that, because nobody wants to be a part of it.
And you give them their individual identity.
Right. We all deal with that on some level in our lives, you know, whatever it is. So nobody likes it.
People are always putting me in the tall, white, heterosexual male box. Yeah. And I feel like, you know, there's a ceiling.
You're a prisoner.
You know, I can't even joke about that anymore. No. I feel guilty now, but, but there's my guilt. But yeah, I agree with you. There's with all sorts of disability films. Mm-hmm. I did a disability in college. I took this class, this master's level class, and it was like disability in film, and it was really, really educational. It was great. And for the longest time, and still often, there's this trend of in storytelling, when you give a character a disability, you have to replenish them with another a super ability. So if the character's blind, their healing has to be awesome. Or Rain Man.
Can count matchsticks.
Yeah.
And there was a case like in that film where, and even though he doesn't have Asperger's, because Asperger's is on the spectrum.
It's on the spectrum, and technically, they've taken away the diagnosis of Asperger's, and just everybody's on the they're just on the spectrum. But
maybe everybody alive is on the spectrum.
That's why it's called the spectrum. Sure.
Oh, really? So even people that are undiagnosed and considered socially and whatever, you don't have
the
setbacks.
When I tell people I made a movie about these guys with Asperger's, so many times they'll say, people say, well, I think I've got a touch of Asperger's. Instead of just correcting them, I feel like the best thing I can say is, I think we can all relate to certain sensitivities and you know, certain struggles.
Right. And the people say that are not saying it. Again, they're not saying it with a...
No, they're not. Right, but it's nice to get everybody a little more educated on that.
It's funny when you said... touched with Asperger's. I was remembering an expression when I was a kid. People would call people that had some sort of developmental issue touched. Do you remember that?
That's right.
It's a bygone expression, but I don't hear it anymore. But what a strange thing. And it was not meant in a pejorative way. It was meant to be a sensitive way of explaining it.
Yeah.
Because we had another term which begins with an R, where we just put everybody in a basket of retards, kind of. It's, you know, and in Boston, I'm sure they got hit hard because becomes a generic expression. You retad. But it's funny how touched was like a way of describing somebody. They're touched.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's almost like a way of saying like having a gift of some kind when you're touched by God, touched by good fortune, touched by what? I don't know. What does touched mean?
Yeah, that's. It's an interesting.
Sorry,
no.
Going off the rails.
What's the where your body is decomposing and like you can't touch people.
When you're like when they used to put, when they put people on like an island because there was people walking around with it wasn't gangrene but it was shit.
I'm bad at remembering words.
Me too.
Is that a life skill? Like, is that something I need?
No. But it's funny because. I keep coming back to Adam Driver in the Noah Baumbach film. While We're Young, let's just not know. Did you see that?
I have not seen. Wait, in the Noah Baumbach.
There's a scene where Naomi Watts and Ben Stiller are older couple.
Gotcha.
And Adam Driver and a cute blonde girl, Amanda Seyfried. They're sitting around and they forget something, the name of something, and Ben reaches for his iPhone to get the answer, and Adam Driver goes, "Hey. Let's just not know." Like it was such a millennial response, like a hipster guy. He's a total hipster, and his solution was, you know,
that's so wise.
Is a great it is.
That's so wise.
Well, let's just know. last thing I was going to say. Adam. Okay, right. You have to go to a Q&A. No. We're done. Q&A. You're doing Q&A at the Village East, so you have to get going. But I want to say, if you get a chance, a new Jim Jarmusch film. Which is called Patterson.
Patterson, yeah.
Not to be confused with Iggy
Pop. I really
saw that this week, and
how was it?
It was good. It's not, nothing happens. I mean, it's one of those films. It's a very small film. It will not nobody will see this film because they just won't.
They're... Just like the movie Blue Jay, very little happens.
Okay, that's fine.
There is room for it. I'm a fan of Jarmusch.
I'm hoping to get him on this show one day. He doesn't do that type of thing.
Tell him I say hi.
I will.
He doesn't know me.
Okay, but Adam Driver is the lead character, He's a poet.
A poet, bus driver.
Yes, right. Poet named Patterson, driving in Patterson.
So. Yeah.
Okay, so to wrap things up here with filmmaker Alex Lehman.
It's Lehman, but Lehman? I can change it to Lehman. Change it to whatever people.
Linus say. Lehman.
Yeah.
No, it's Alex Lehman. Well, you know, when people say either is fine, I say no. What does your mother call you or something? You know, it's like just I want to know what
my
you.
My mother calls me Ati.
Ati.
Yeah. Okay.
Is that French or something? Or
it is French, I guess. It's more.
Alexandre, when she's obsessed with Alexandre.
Alexandre.
Yeah, Alexandre. Okay, so right now, in New York at the Village East, you can see, as we speak, Asperger's or Us, which again is the name, refers to the name of these guys' comedy troupe.
Yep, that's the name of their troupe.
Yeah. And
every now and then people see that and they think that it's a regular sketch comedy troupe that's making jokes about Asperger's. So
those people are retards. That comes out.
Hopefully they click on the link on iTunes.
Yes.
November 15th and say, hey, I'm going to buy this movie so that I can complain about the fact that they're making fun of Asperger's, and then they'll watch it and realize, oh, we're not making fun of Asperger's.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking out loud. I'm going to wait till after the 15th, I think.
That's good.
Because I think it'll do better if we let people stop listening to this show. I think they're going to like you a lot. And then from this podcast, people listening, I think they're going to like you. Thanks. And I think what they're going to do is right now, I'm going to go and watch Asperger's or Us, and then I'm going to watch Blue Jay. Because they can, because they're both available on iTunes.
That's the world we live in.
And so do that. Now, I want to say, if you're in New York, though, everything's always better on a big screen. And it's important for filmmakers to have audiences go to their movies in the movie theater. So go see it at the Village East in L.A. coming up on the 6th. What day was it? The 18th?
18th.
18th. 18th is it's going to be at the Arena Theater in Los Angeles. So, and then is it having a theatrical in Boston? It should, right?
We're going to have a couple showings at the Somerville Theater. Okay. Walking those down.
I like that theater. Yeah. It's a small theater, but that's where the Independent Film Festival of Boston is based out of.
Yeah, we screened it there, actually.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. That was a nice homecoming for
the guys. You screened it at that festival? Mm-hmm. I was there for opening day, and I got my badge, and my intention was to keep coming back that weekend, but I was staying with these friends in Marlborough, Massachusetts, which is like a trip out
it's
of
a
it.
Hike.
It is, but I hadn't seen them in ages, and I ended up just staying out there, and I didn't get to the festival. So my apologies to that festival. Thank you very much, Alex, and come back. We'll do this again, right?
Yeah,
and
for sure.
Yeah, and if you can get...
I think I'm done.
Clue,
I made two movies. I think...
You're done for a bit?
For life.
Or life?
Yeah.
No, I think that's your... You think it's true.
No, I'm kidding. I'm addicted.
And we got to get Mark... Jay was on the show with... Manson Family Vacation.
Cool.
But he was lost in a little bit of a crowd because I had the director and I had the Linus on. And so, but I want to get the both. I got to get the Duplasses on. So if you can, I know they're busy guys, but it's important. And then Clue. Let's get Clue on the show. I'd love to talk to him. I can do it on the phone.
Clue's the best. I will put you in touch with Clue.
Yeah, just put me in touch. And if I, okay.
Yes.
Thank you very much for getting
Thanks
together.
Thanks for having me here.
Alrighty. Now, don't you think I should be able to get the Mark Duplass on this show at some point? I mean, is it possible? I mean, what did I do last week? A couple weeks ago, we had on Linus with his film Rainbow Time, which was also executive produced by the Duplass brothers, and Jay Duplass was in it. And this week, we've got Alex on, and what a lovely guy he was. But, you know, they executive produced both of his films, I believe, right? So, come on. Mark, if you're listening, do me a kindness. Come on to FilmWax Radio. Guys, tweet Mark Duplass. He's on Twitter. Let's see. His handle is @MarkDuplass. Duplass. You can tweet him and say, check out Film Wax Radio. Consider going on the show. Let's be polite about it. And then you can put at Film Wax Radio in there. So if you're listening, nudge Mark Duplass to come onto the show, okay? So in the meantime, last up here, True New York, again, an omnibus is a collection of short films. Usually they're revolve around a common theme. In this case, it's all these kind of quirky aspects of around New York City. First Run Features is distributing it. It's currently available on DVD and also on streaming on demand on iTunes. And this is the description. In a city with 8 million people, there's bound to be a few good stories. True New York is a feature-length compilation anthology film, which I call an omnibus, by the way, featuring 5 award-winning short documentaries and the amazing characters who call the city home. True New York is a one-of-a-kind film for a one-of-a-kind city, tied together with stunning timescape footage. True New York features 5 short films. Let's see, Sea Rock, which is a cliff on the Hudson River. I think it's in the Bronx. And it's directed by Jordan Roth. And it just shows all these young folks that jump off. It becomes a rite of passage. Taxi Garage by Filmwax Radio friend and guest Joshua Weinstein. Joshua's on many episodes back with the feature-length version of this documentary, which was called Drivers Wanted. This is a short called Taxi Garage. One Track Mind is directed by our friend Jeremy, who's going to be on the show in a second. And will be joined by the co-director Sam Cullman and Ben Rosen with their short Black Cherokee. And last is A Son's Sacrifice, directed by Yoni Brook. I hope to get on Yoni, by the way, in a future episode. Yoni, if you're listening. And the Sea Rock director, Jordan Roth. I hope to get those guys on the show eventually, too. Consider that an invitation, guys. In the meantime, let's get into this last segment here, which was, again, recorded at the Showbiz Studios. This is my conversation with Jeremy Workman, Sam Cullman, and Ben Rosen. And then we'll be back.
I've been driving a cab since 1945.
Hey, listen, how do you be a successful artist? You be a successful artist by having customers.
Having a father that was Muslim and a mother that was Puerto Rican wasn't exactly easy.
The good Lord is good to me. I'll live to see the end of this thing yet.
Me and Billy jump down that far. See how far you can jump.
Whoa!
That's a run.
I'm cool, and I ain't no fool.
To be a good cab driver, you gotta look ahead and think ahead.
I've done a lot, I know. I spent a lot of years on it, but I haven't accomplished that much. I've only gone through two subway lines, really.
An odd playground. 10,000 volts of electricity and rats.
The film is being released on VOD and iTunes on November 15th, and then additional venues after.
So I'm going to put on right after November 15th. That way, people who hear it and then all of a sudden they want to watch it, they can do it immediately. They don't have to, like, you lose people if you just say, hey, it's coming out in 3 weeks. Then, you know, nobody's going to care.
It was funny because even like in the old days, like you would put a trailer out, you know, weeks in advance of a movie. Even if it was, I don't even mean Hollywood movies, like even just like small little indie movies. That's almost like a waste now. People don't want that. They want to be able to, like, there's a trailer or something, there's publicity, and they could click a button and watch it. Yeah.
They say times have changed. I haven't seen any evidence of it myself. Okay. this is Adam Shartoff, host of Film Wax Radio. We're in the Showbiz Studios. I'm really thrilled to be surrounded by just you're all Jews, right? It's like we've got half.
You can smell it.
Yeah.
Is it my nose?
We're just a bunch of Jewish guys sitting around schmoozing today about the project that we're going to talk about is called True New York. And it is I called it an omnibus. It's a loosely connected bunch of short documentaries curated by Jeremy Workman, the filmmaker, Jeremy Workman, and the trailer maker, who is here today. Hi, Jeremy.
Hello. Thanks for having us.
Welcome back.
I rarely, if ever, have used the term omnibus, but I like it.
Yeah.
I like it. I love the omnibus. I might start.
I really like omnibus films.
personally.
Me too.
Yeah. There's some great ones out there. This is the first time you've been on my podcast without your father.
That is correct. Right? My father is a filmmaker, Chuck Workman. He had a film. His last film was Magician, a documentary on Orson Welles that we did together.
Right.
When my feature, Magical Universe, was coming out literally the same month.
Right.
Cohen Media released Magician. IFC Films released my film. So there was a lot of press that we did together, including your show.
Right. No,
which was, I think, the first time we had done it. Oh. And then subsequently a couple other venues came after that.
And if you listen back, I don't have the episode number in front of me, but if you listen back to that episode, I'm not sure if your dad, if it comes up, that Chuck would reach out to Henry and maybe help him get him on the him on the show. But it took about a year. But Henry Jackman came on the show.
Yeah, and
via Skype.
Yes, and Henry, I had made a documentary on Henry Jackman.
Oh, that's right, of course.
Which I know have seen.
Yeah, and he's and distributed by the same distributor that is distributing True New York.
It's all connected.
Oh my God, what are the odds? And that is First Run Features. We're going to say that at the.
That's right. My first feature documentary, Who is Henry Jackman? Is with First Run. So I had a relationship with those guys there, Mark and Seymour, and had previously done films with them. So it was a natural fit when we brought True New York to them.
This is five short films that are New Yorkers shorts, right? I mean, this is how I would say it. It's like it's real New York. It's not like, you know, superficial New York stuff that you know. This is for a film that even New Yorkers could really, really dig because it's really gets into the characters or the character of New York in a way that you don't see typically.
Like yeah,
in a Hollywood movie.
Absolutely.
Or,
so what this is five short films that are all have New York City as the backdrop, take place in New York. They're all sort of tied also because they have, you know, quirky, intriguing characters like Ben and Sam's film Black Cherokee. And
wait a minute, what was that called? No, I'm kidding. I saw it. Yeah, I did.
The idea was, well, first of all, one idea was just the fact that there's so many amazing shorts out there that kind of don't really get much play after their festival runs.
True.
And they're so good. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them are just sort of out to pasture a little bit. You know, they're just out there and they don't.
Well, first of all, I'm being rude. Hello to Sam Coleman and Ben Rosen, who have, like Jeremy just mentioned, co-directed one of the shorts called Black Cherokee, and we'll talk about that in a minute. I also want to mention another previous guest, Joshua Weinstein, who came on. I even hosted a screening with him of Drivers Wanted, which is the feature version of the short that he has in this omnibus.
Let me just add to that, which is film is Taxi Garage, not to be confused with Taxi Driver. Taxi Garage.
So Peter Boyle isn't in it.
No. And which he adapted from Drivers Wanted. And just to add to that about your screening, we were jumping ahead, but we were putting together DVD special features and extras for True New York. And Josh said, hey, I have this cool, special feature montage where Adam Shartoff gives we do a screening at it was at a taxi depot.
No, it was at the garage.
Yeah, it was
Stan
there.
55.
Right. And you see like taxis Stan, coming in and out. And
oh yeah. It was just one of those. It was a beautiful late summer, early fall night because it was after. It could have been during the summer. I can't remember now because Rooftop Films basically donated the hardware, the screen, and the projector and all that. Thank you again, by the way, to those guys. I think we just had to pay, and by we I mean Josh, for the guys to who set it up and who were there.
Yeah, and that's a great film on this taxi depot in Queens and mostly about this one older guy, Spider, who is the oldest taxi was. He passed away.
He died days later.
Yeah, and he was the oldest taxi driver. He was in his 80s and had been...
I think.
Yeah, 90s?
Maybe.
And was been a taxi cab driver his entire life in New York City. So that was one of the first ones we went after for this omnibus. Anyway, just to quickly finish up on that, we were going to include that as a special feature, and then Josh sent it to me, and it was a 30-second montage. So
okay.
But I saw you in the footage.
Oh, okay. Well, it was a lot of fun.
Yes.
Ben and Sam are here. They again, co-directed a short called Black Cherokee, which is really great, which follows this, what would you call, what's his name? The guy?
Otis Houston Jr.
Who is, you know, he's a unique kind of guy, I guess you could say, right? He's got a spot on the FDR, or is it Harlem River Drive? Whatever.
Right, like, on the border of the FDR and the Harlem River Drive.
Oh, okay. Yep. And he kind of does this, I would say, performative art work, you know, interactive with drivers that are going by. It's interesting because you don't really know too much about what he's thinking about. It's really just observational, this documentary. Is that fair to say? I found that the short doesn't interview people that know Otis, but it's observational. So we just know what we see.
Yeah, I think
this
that
is Ben talking.
This Ben Rosen. Hi, thanks mm-hmm. for having us. Mm-hmm. I think that the film in some ways charts our journey as filmmakers getting to know Otis. And, you know, at first, certainly we wanted to approach it as a classic verite style documentary and be very sort of passive and
right.
observational mm-hmm. and, you know, let the subject sort of carry yeah. the story. But I think as the film progresses, you know, we obviously follow the artist back to his home. We meet his family. That was our experience making the film. We obviously got to know him better. But we were obviously conscious about restraining ourselves and not interviewing him and not being, you know, overly direct with, you know, trying to put, trying to categorize him and his story, because he is such a mysterious person as he remains to us. He remains yeah. that way.
How long was the shoot?
It took
Sam.
A long. Hey, sorry. Mm-hmm. Yes,
no,
I'm
sir.
Sam.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for having us.
Oh, yeah,
it took a long time. I think not necessarily because it had to, but because of the constraints of being a filmmaker and trying to do many different things in one's life. And also because I think Otis's story that we were following didn't have, you know, sort of the classic goalposts of, you know, this is the beginning, the middle, and the end. So we had the opportunity to sort of just, like, hang out with him and film
yeah,
him over the course of time.
That's kind of what I was trying to yeah. know, express, I guess, yeah.
Just to piggyback of what Ben was saying, you know, the choice to make this film in a verite style was really, I think, reflective of what we saw in Otis, because, you know, here was this guy who does this very intriguing, mysterious thing on the FDR, and your experience of him as a viewer, as like a citizen of New York, is you see him for these, like, you know, this contained 10 to 30 to 45 second moment when you're passing by him as he's doing this performance art thing. And, you know, we wanted to get behind that, and we didn't want to get behind that in a way where we kind of told you, we wanted you to experience it in the way that we had, because it felt like, you know, when you talking to people, because he is sort of like this iconic mystery in New York, I think. And I think, you know, people projected their assumptions about who he was and why he was. And, you know, lots of that was, is he crazy? Is he unhinged? Is, like, does he even know what he's doing? And we wanted, you know, him to answer those questions himself, you know, by showing us what he had.
I asked about how long it took to, because I can imagine as you do make a film about a person, and a person who is likable or intriguing or both, that, you know, the longer it takes, the more you feel an allegiance and a friendship even. And so it does get harder to keep, you know, that neutral documentary air or position, and because you get more involved, you know, on an emotional level.
Certainly. And, you know, Otis, he's very performative and extroverted by nature. And so from the beginning, he was sort of an open book, and he had, you know, many shticks that he, you know, sort of gave to us. And I mean, he's been interviewed. He's appeared in various periodicals.
He's been on New York
over
one.
The years. New York One. There's New Yorker, New York Post. Lots of stuff. And you know, he's a very social guy. So he offered us like some typical things that he had done with other journalists before. But then we stuck around, and he wasn't necessarily prepared for that, I think. And he let his guard down, you know, over the course of time. And I think that's when we got to some of the more interesting material.
For sure.
Yeah, and I think it their film really does reflect a lot of the agendas that we were looking for when we went about, you know, curating it. We saw Black Cherokee and we loved it. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about me, my producing partner, Rob, First Run, Mark at First Run. And, you know, when we were looking at films, we were looking at a lot of shorts for this anthology. And
roughly?
I mean, we probably saw 40 or 50. Mm-hmm. We had a lot of words out to people. Different people were sending us suggestions, including Dan Nuxall from Rooftop, and a lot of film festival people. We were looking for films about that took
Rooftop
place.
Does their New York shorts.
Yeah, and in fact, one of our really great ones, Sea Rock, was.
Oh yeah.
Was a suggestion from a Dan.
That's a great one. Unlike your short, which we'll get to, mm-hmm. called
One Track Mind,
and Black Cherokee. This is about more of about an institution or a New York
rite of passage.
That's a better way of putting it. Yeah. But we can talk about that in a minute too, because I really enjoyed that one.
Yeah.
That
was... So we spent a good year. Maybe a little less than a year, looking at shorts, talking, you know, looking at every New York City themed short from maybe the last 5 to 10 years.
Yeah.
You know,
you didn't feel too much pressure to keep it brand new.
Yeah, we felt like the whole brand new thing was a decision. You know, at one point we were like, oh, should these all be, you know, new releases? And then we felt like the better movies were not always brand new. And one of our goals was one of our ideas was every short has to be great, not just good, mm-hmm. but every short has to be great, and every short has to sort of stand alone as a movie, and not just as, oh, that's a cool, like, quirky 15 minutes that you know, about some quirky subject, but that every single one is a movie in its own right.
It's sort of like when you're watching a feature, let's say, where there's multiple threads, and you know, they go in between the different threads of the movie or the different you know, subplots, what have you, and you get lost in that one, and then it breaks and it goes to another one. You're like, oh darn it, I was so into it, and then you're into this new one. And then that happens again, and then, you know, you're finding that they're all perfect.
Yeah,
they all stand alone, these stories, you know.
Yeah, we were looking towards movies, you know, just as not so much in the documentary world. We were looking at like New York Stories, you know, the anthology film that Woody Allen and Scorsese and Coppola did, and I think that was 90. So we were, or maybe
that long ago?
88, maybe. Something like that.
It was in there. Yeah,
we were looking at films like that.
Not Four Rooms.
Four Rooms is another one. You know, Four Rooms wasn't so successful.
No, but, it was not.
And I'm sure a lot of audiences have already forgotten Four Rooms.
I had one of the filmmakers on the show.
Allison Anders.
No, I've been chasing her for a while, but Alexander Rockwell.
Okay, so Four Rooms, for those of you that don't remember, all took place in a hotel in the late 90s, and it was like it was right at Tarantino's.
Late 80s.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I guess, right, but that's when the film came out.
Yeah.
And it was Tarantino kind of like...
Oh, right.
Just launching into the interstellar space, you know, as an icon.
It was a mess.
Yeah, and the whole movie doesn't quite work.
It doesn't gel. I was going to say that there's also Je T'aime, you know, Paris, and then I Love New York. There's that series. That's also another omnibus. So I was thinking you could do True, you know, Nebraska.
It certainly
True Hawaii. Yeah. Let's start with True Hawaii.
Let me
get involved in that.
We're hoping that True New York, you know, finds an audience, and we could follow it up with True Paris, True L.A.,
Paris.
True San Fran.
Oh, you're even thinking bigger.
You know,
Sam,
have you guys done any films at other you know, cities that we could profile?
So this was definitely supposed to be True New York City.
Yes,
but you call it True New York.
It's
shorthand.
Is,
okay,
it is
I'm just I'm not,
yes.
not judging. I'm just making this.
So yes, we were trying to find the best films that took place in New York City, that you know, again, that were substantial, that had substance. What does that mean? That, right. you know, that have a beginning, middle, and end. You know, we love Black Cherokee because it was so, as these guys mentioned, you know, it didn't feel, it felt like a real movie. It was observational. It was verite. It's really well made. The characters, quirky and weird New York, okay. Mm-hmm. But how they make it is really great.
Yeah. And among all the films that I've seen that take place on the FDR, this is right at the top, I have to tell you guys. Well, it's interesting because we made a reference to Sea Rock, which is the first, I think, which is about this rite of passage, well said, where kids jump off the cliff. There's various jumping off points of heights, and they all have nicknames, but they're... There's a area. Is this the Bronx, by the way?
Yeah,
it is the Bronx, right? Yeah. On the Hudson, though.
Yes,
right.
Yes, it's really one of our standout films in the anthology. The director is Jordan Roth. It's his first film, and it looks incredible. It really, again, the cinematography is amazing.
Like, it's beautiful.
Jumping off cliffs with these kids who are doing this sort of
bandit. There's almost a point late into the short where. There's like an ecstasy occurs and with the music and the jumping, and it's like, you know, you reach a point of almost like ecstasy watching this movie. So
there's Black, and the order, you know, we tried to also shape it so it had a little bit of order. So we begin with Sea Rock, which is about this youthful, you know, exuberance, and then it moves into Taxi Garage,
right,
and starts profiling, getting a little deeper, and then it does One Track Mind, which is a film that I directed a few years ago, yeah. And that's about a subway historian, this kind of crazy, obsessive subway historian, and then it goes into Yoni Brooks' film, A Son's Sacrifice, right. Which is also really great, you know?
I saw that actually also. I did see it some years ago at DCTV.
Okay, so that's one of the older films in it. It's only a few years old, but it's about a slaughterhouse in Queens and the changing of the guard between the father and the son, and the son has sort of a different value system, and he's half Puerto Rican and doesn't totally feel a connection to the Muslim community. And it's great, you know, it's 30 minutes, and we also thought that was another one that just sort of fit right in. Mm-hmm. And then we sort of end with Black Cherokee, which, you know, really feels like it puts a cap on this idea of people in New York trying to do something, still going at it, not giving up. Those were some of the themes we really felt were strong in it.
And this will be coming out in, as you said, on demand, right?
Is it November 15th.
November 15th.
Yeah, I know, you know,
when people are listening to this should be in the past.
Right. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, we're looking for there's not a lot of anthology documentaries coming out. So it's a little bit of an optimistic experiment for all of us, including First Run. So First Run features, you know, that releases a lot of great documentaries.
Yeah.
You know, just has an incredible track record of just really just terrific docs. True. You know, none of us were really sure. Is there going to be an audience for this? We think so. The movies are good. Mm-hmm. So we're first releasing it on traditional DVD.
Okay.
And potentially Blu-ray, iTunes. And then from there, it might then go on to VOD, you know, kind of whatever, on demand, mm-hmm. And those kind of venues. November 15th is when it sort of goes public.
Okay. Very good. I was walking. I'm living in Park Slope. I was driving from my kids. I guess dropping the kids. I don't remember. But I passed Marshall Curry on the street. He was probably walking over to his office in Windsor Terrace or something. So I thought of you. Because you, Sam.
Do you say
I say. Because, well, I see Marshall. You know, I run into him. But you worked with him, right?
If a Tree Falls.
If a Tree Falls. Yeah. Did you help shoot that or edit?
I shot it and produced it and co-directed it.
Okay.
Yeah. And you know, I cut the trailer.
And Jeremy cut the trailer.
Well, it's like kind of superfluous to say almost. What trailers haven't you cut?
I mean, if it's a documentary coming out.
You're probably the guy.
Yeah. I mean, I'm doing a lot of the documentaries, which is cool.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my company is.
Yeah.
But we had initially, you know, I had known Marshall. I didn't know Sam.
Mm-hmm.
And I had also been, there was some back and forth when his film Art and Craft came out.
Right.
I think Oscilloscope released them.
Yes.
Yeah. And Oscilloscope also released If a Tree Falls.
Yes.
And
oh, right.
I had done trailers with them. And so it was funny. So when people told me about, oh, you got to see this, there's this great film, Black Cherokee, about this, you know, street performance guy, I didn't know of it. And I then looked and I was like, oh, wow, Sam Coleman made it. I definitely have connections to him. Mm-hmm. And that was when we reached out and saw it. It came in very late. It was our last film that we put in.
Yeah. Cool. Shoehorned it in at the end there.
Yeah, there was some, there was always, you know, like short films, as you could imagine, you know, you're dealing with rights, you're dealing with licensing issues. There were some films that we wanted, we couldn't get. There were some films that we tried so it took us a while, and Black Cherokee sort of fit right in.
Awesome.
It's a great group of shots. Let's mention One Track Mind a little bit more. Mm-hmm. Talk about that one a little bit more, too, because that's yours. This is, what's the character's name?
Phil Coppola. And he's fascinating.
He really is.
Yeah. So I made a 25-minute short on him, One Track Mind, and it premiered at Tribeca, and then it played at a couple really great venues and you know, had a great run, a festival run, but then it kind of petered out, like a lot of shorts, you know, and it didn't really necessarily find a home after that. And then all of a sudden there was some interest in it, and the New York Times ran an article on the subject. Now, why would the New York Times run, you know, do that? Which is, the guy, Phil, has been writing a history of the New York City subway stations for 40 years.
Yeah, and it's his goal to complete
the
entire... So there's almost 500 stops? Is that what
497
or something
like that. Yeah. So what Phil does is he goes from stop to stop and he analyzes the decor.
Right.
And he writes the mosaics, the faience, the terracotta. He draws them. He, and has written a book that's literally, I think it's 12 inches high at this point. Wow. It's his self-published encyclopedia. So I had met him. He had been a friend of mine for a while. And kind of like these guys with Black Cherokee, I was making a film on him just on the side for a while. Finished that film, and that was One Track Mind. So then it was kind of, you know, it was kind of out there. But then a New York Times writer, David Dunlop, who has this ongoing column, he wanted to really dig into Phil. And that was a year ago. Or a little bit more than a year ago, there was a big article on Phil, and they said, oh, and there's this short, One Track Mind. And then from there, there was immediate interest, you know, from the Transit Museum to play it, and National Arts Club, and all these different places wanted to show this short. So at that point, there was somewhere along the line where I was talking to First Run, and I made a crack. I was like, too bad this thing's not a feature. You guys could release it. And then we kind of came up with this concept of, well, why don't we put together a few others and profile New York in a way and then do this as the film.
Okay, that's the origin
story.
That's
it.
Yeah, well, that seems to me that the New York Times might be interested in this too.
Yeah, I mean, anyone who's,
anyone who's interested in
New York and, I think it definitely has broad appeal. I mean, the films are all, you know, they hit different regions in New York, different demographics. Right.
Yes, for sure. It's a very diverse group of subjects.
It's very outer borough, the whole anthology a little bit.
Yeah, like those early Rahman Barani films were.
Yeah.
Like in that way where he's more interested in.
Yeah. And the other thing is, when we were going, we were imagining the kind of films, it was, like I was saying before, you know, these ones that kind of had, that felt substantial. But also what we noticed was that there was all these great filmmakers too. Mm-hmm. And that all the filmmakers in the collection are really, have made other films. And I thought that was really interesting too. C-Rock is the only one where it was a first-timer. Everybody else has done significant stuff.
Right. And somebody like Josh Weinstein, who we talked about with the Taxi Garage and all that, he's also just shot endless amounts of stuff.
He's
like,
a great
different people.
DP. Yoni's a great DP. Sam, I know you're a DP. Others have done features. So it was definitely, you know, what we saw was that it was, the level of filmmaking was really high.
Yeah, it's true. So anyway, guys, what do you think? What do you think of this collection of shorts? How do you think it came out?
Yeah, how do you guys think, you know, being on it? What's your take on this?
I mean, it was like, for us, a real a manna from heaven kind of situation. We'll go with the Jewish scene that we began this podcast on with. Only, I mean, you know, like, as you mentioned, Jeremy, you know, these films, you work on them mainly because you have to, which is sort of what we felt when we you know, someone's got to tell Otis the story. Let's do it. But when it became clear that it was a short, that obviously, you know, meant, unfortunately, because of the distribution models play, that, like, probably a lot of people weren't going to see it.
And now it's getting a chance to come in, even out on physical product, which is kind of nice. You could always have a copy around and play it for your friends. And
it's really nice to have another life.
He's a stocking stuffer.
Grandma's stocking stuffer. On the Jewish
Make the jokes into the microphone. Tough guy. Well, I just came from seeing the new Kenneth Lonergan film, Manchester by the Sea.
It's pretty good.
It was really Casey Affleck is the lead in that, and really great job. Just saying.
For all those people trying to raise millions of dollars for their movies, about 2 years ago, one of the financiers of that movie came to my company, and we created a 2 or 3 minute piece that didn't use any footage, that just used interviews with Kenneth Lonergan, Casey, Michelle Williams, Matt Damon, and created he was a producer on it, right? Created like a little like featurette for a movie that didn't exist, and they used that as a way for fundraising.
Oh, very good. So they don't just use those featurettes for Kickstarter. They have other uses.
It was essentially a Kickstarter for a mega movie that apparently is a front runner to win the Oscar.
He's like an outlier. He's making these movies that very few other people, well, I guess some people are making, but like these dramatic films with great actors in it and that have budgets. It seems, I don't know, it's pretty amazing. Because you don't get that. You know, I realize how few American films like that I get to watch every year. You know? So in the budgeted world. I mean, you know, there's lots of independent films that sort of do that. So, but anyway.
Let me tell one last story I first connected with Black Cherokee, which was I'm about 2 or 3 years in now on a feature documentary about Matt Green, who maybe some of your listeners were even familiar of. He's a 35-year-old guy who's walking every street of New York City over 5 years, 7 years, something like that. It's 8,000 miles.
It's 8,000 miles?
Yeah.
Is this just Manhattan?
No.
Or is it? It's all New York City?
Everywhere.
That doesn't make sense.
8,000 miles.
8,000 miles, which is, how many miles is the circumference of the planet? I know it's more than eight. I'm not a complete moron, but I'm just trying to kind of put it in perspective.
Put it in perspective. It's three times walking across the country,
which I think only Art Garfunkel has achieved.
No, subject of this documentary, Matt, also walked across the country a few years ago.
Just his MetroCard ran out or whatever. He doesn't have an easy pass. So this is remarkable.
It's remarkable.
Can we get him on the show?
Yes, in less than a year, we'll do a whole thing.
Jesus Christ.
He's very fascinating.
He's going to finish it.
He's 75-80% done. So I've been making a film on him now for a while.
How does he... Mm-hmm. All right, just real quick, since you brought it up now, I'm a little
There is a connection to Black Cherokee.
Go ahead, finish that.
So Matt is sort of has quirky interests and curiosities, and he was obsessed, has become kind of obsessed with Otis Houston, who is this artist,
who is the subject of Black Cherokee
right. Who, as they mentioned, performs on the side of the FDR Drive. So
I mentioned it.
Yeah, okay. So anytime we're like in range of Harlem,
yes.
Matt and I would often try to go see if Otis Houston was around.
Even though it's off his grid?
Even though he's done those streets and it's kind of off his grid. Because Matt felt that Otis Houston shares a lot there's a commonality between the two, and he really wanted to meet.
There is. Well, Matt, does he know that the chances of him having a family are very small at this chance?
Yes.
Okay, he does. Okay.
Yes. I interviewed some of his former, girlfriends and whatnot. They talk about that.
Yeah.
So anyway, we went 6 or 7 times to try to find Otis, Matt and I, and we just kept on going and me with a camera, and he was never there. We would see evidence of him. So finally, I think I had reached out to about Black Cherokee first before True New York. I had even just reached out to Sam about, hey, can you give me any intel? Something like that,
Yeah.
About finding Otis Houston. Yeah. And he sent me the film. And then at that point, I was like, whoa, wait a second. This film is so great. It's something that we should consider for True New York. And it was like, it totally worked out. One film dropped out and we were able to fit it in.
That's a great story. Yeah. It'll be interesting to develop an app. Where is Matt Green? You know, like where is he today? Does he have a job?
We still haven't done it. No. We still haven't found him.
That's too bad.
I mean, and I know there's phone numbers for Otis.
Yeah, I can give you a phone number.
We haven't done that yet. We're trying to make it.
Try not to take a shortcut.
Yeah, we want it to be spontaneous.
And organic. Exactly.
Yeah. As you know, any documentarian would know. You know, you don't want to stage stuff too much.
No, not too much. Right?
Just enough.
Yeah, so, does he have a job, Matt?
He does not have a job. He lives on $15 a day. Mm-hmm. He couch surfs. He got rid of his apartment. He sold a lot of possessions. He had some savings.
They used to call that homeless.
Now exactly. He's a bum. He would be the first to admit it.
Bum.
He couch surfs. He cat sits. He plant sits. I do have a friend like that. All right.
I have a friend like that who, yeah.
He hasn't owned rented an apartment for 7 or 8 years.
Okay.
And has managed to live in New York.
Uh-huh.
And is also, besides just the walk, he does research on everywhere he goes.
Okay. Right. Well, I was thinking that he probably documents. Mm-hmm. It's an amazing thing.
Listeners should check out his blog, which is not his primary focus, but he definitely has a cool blog that... he puts photos up called imjustwalkin.com.
I'm just walking. Mm-hmm. No G there. Okay, guys, let's wind down. But, Jeremy, how do people... Let's also... I always forget to ask, like, if people want to find your work and your films, because you've got also a couple of great features, a number of great features.
So, if first of all, with True New York or just in general?
No, in general.
So people can find me if they're interested in movie trailers, of course. They could find me at my company, which is called Wheelhouse Creative, and it's here in New York City. And
if you're looking to get a trailer made, yes, that's
good... Adam mentioned earlier, we do a lot of trailers for documentaries and indie films. We work for a lot of the indie distributors. So, that is my company, and through which I also make films under that banner. Magical Universe is on Netflix. That was a movie I did on an outsider artist that shares a lot of commonality with Sam's film, Art and Craft.
Yep. I love that movie. But yeah. Art and Craft was great.
Yeah. Sometimes they've been grouped together. Mm-hmm.
There is a subgenre, right, of you know, artists.
Outsider artists. Does Art and Craft get listed in, like, outside artists, or is it more...
You know, it has, but we always resisted that because, you know, Mark himself never considered himself an artist, which is part of the paradox of the story that we're trying to tell in that movie, but...
That's the one about the guy who he's essentially...
A forger.
Yeah.
He forged for 30 years, forged art for 30 years and traveled around the country pretending as though he was a philanthropist trying to give them away to museums who actually took quite a lot of them.
Yeah. Amazing story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, because he's a forger, he always likes to downplay his skills and always would say that, like, he never has an original thought. So he can't be an artist. We question that, just in talking to him, because his project is kind of like an art project, right? I mean, it sort of operates that way. Mm-hmm. So.
Sam, how do people also find your work? We've mentioned... Art and Craft, which is distributed by Oscilloscope, and so it's probably on a number of major digital platforms.
That's right. Yeah, Oscilloscope really put that film out quite widely, so it is quite accessible. iTunes and all, you know, Netflix has the disc, and Amazon's got the streaming rights, and yeah, you can find it, which is great. I've been lucky to collaborate with a lot of people in my career, and Ben being one of them with Black Cherokee. So I have a website where you can. You know, where my film company is, but I don't distribute my own stuff. Yellow Cake Films is me.
What are you working on now?
I've been developing a project that I'm like at that moment of like looking myself in the mirror about whether it's real or not, but about police and policing and the policed. Yeah.
And Ben, what about you?
So I'm at BenjaminRosen.com. I have a feature documentary called A Stadium Story that I did 10 years ago about New York City's attempt to put, ill-fated attempt to put a football stadium over the Hudson Yards on the west side of Manhattan.
Uh-huh. I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. So that that's you can purchase a DVD directly from me off our website, astadiumstory.com. Uh-huh. And I have a few projects, a few irons in the fire that
Well, you'll come back and you'll bring us up to date when the time is right.
For sure.
All you guys. Thank you very much. Again, let's just one more time mention that right now, as we're ending this segment here on the show, you can now go to...
You could find True New York on iTunes.
On iTunes.
You could go on Amazon. Buy a DVD. I'm sure you could get it on First Run Features website.
My copy.
You will get your copy signed by all of us.
Brings down the value, but what the heck.
We expect... can't pop it back on eBay, you know. So anyway, we will... we expect it to also find its way into your living room with On Demand. But most immediately, people could go right onto iTunes... Or right onto websites by Google it. It'll come right up.
True New York, which is the name of the omnibus, and it's was, I guess, curated by yourself.
Yeah, I'm a producer with my producing partner Rob, and the films are once again Sea Rock, which is about these Bronx boys who do cliff diving. Taxi Garage, which is about this, you know, taxi depot in Queens. One Track Mind, which is this extreme subway historian. A Sun Sacrifice, which is the one about the slaughterhouse in Queens. And of
Yoni
course,
Brooks, yeah.
Yeah, and of course, Black Cherokee, which is about Otis Houston, this performance artist who performs on the FDR.
Well, thanks, everybody. Thanks for coming.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, terrific. Thanks, everybody. If you enjoyed this episode, which was very robust, and I know that I've been putting lots of content up and there's lots more to come. I have another episode I have to post in a couple of days, which will have the filmmakers and a couple of subjects from a new documentary, which is going to be on HBO. In fact, by the time I post this, it will already be on HBO. It's called Marathon, the Patriots Day Bombing. The filmmakers are Annie Sundberg and Ricky Stern, who have been on the show before. They're back, and I'm delighted to have them back. We recorded that at the Hamptons International Film Festival, where I saw Marathon. Also on the next episode is the programmer, film critic, Michael Srego, who works and programs the new Criterion streaming service called Filmstruck. And I've been talking about that for a few weeks now. It just recently launched online, and we're going to have Michael speak at length about this new exciting service, which cinephiles are going to eat up. And then I sat down a few days ago with Asghar Farhadi, who is a new film called The Salesman. You may remember Asghar, who made The Past, and before that, the Oscar-winning film Separation, and a film also called About Ellie, which I must see. I have not seen that one. That film is going to premiere in New York in January. So it's going to be a little while, a couple of months till we post that show. But I'm just letting you know, I still have episodes sitting on the shelf here, dying to put up, but just waiting for the right opportunity with filmmakers like Richard Sandler, Amos Poe, Lizzie Borden, Sam Pollard and Charles Burnett. And looking forward to doing all that. In the meantime, please do go to iTunes. Give me a nice star rating on our FilmWax radio page and leave a comment if you'd be so kind. Like us on Facebook. It's very easy. Facebook.com/FilmWaxRadio. You can follow us on Twitter. Just find us at FilmWax Radio and on Instagram at FilmWax Radio. And join in on the conversation. Thank you very much for listening. This has been episode number 379. FilmWax Radio is part of the Showbiz Studios podcast network, and we're presented by Rooftop Films. So until next time, take care of yourself and the ones you love.
broken lines, broken strings, broken threads, broken springs, broken idols, broken heads. Yeah.